Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through.
Two Georgia police deputies have lost their jobs as a result of racist and sexist Facebook messages that appear to indicate a pattern of targeting African American drivers while on the job. We don't have the exact cutouts from Facebook, but we'd have some of the most incriminating messages leaked from an internal investigation. So here's one. "I have a dream" is next to an image of MLK Jr. saying, "I have a dream that one day my people will not act like animals." That's one of the deputies, Geithner. Owens, the other deputy, responded, "Lol, that'll never happen." So they're making it pretty obvious to see where their bias lies there. Owens, in another post, said, "It's supposed to rain tomorrow, might not get too many nigs," which is uncomfortable to even read from a quotation. Geithner responded, "I hope we get a few, but," and this was crossed out, "if we don't." I think, fuck it, if we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so they go out there hoping every day that they're able to get African-American drivers that they can book for whatever nonsense reason. But unfortunately, the weather might be against them in this particular case, which to a racist is an annoying turn of events.
So to me, the most important part of this revelation, and you know, the racist cops in Georgia, it turns out, oh, shocking.
They found the two.
Yeah. Is that they think, let's go looking for, in their words, nigs, right? And then they go and arrest people, or they pull them over, they look for stuff, they harass them until they arrest enough people. And then they come back and go, "You see that? All the people we arrest are black. We were right all along." No, you went going to harass black people and calling them animals, and then you confirmed your own racist assumptions by arresting the people you had originally targeted.
Yeah.
And so that's that circular reasoning, but they don't get it. And every day, these people who do this think, "Yeah, you see that? I knew it. Look at the jails. It's full of black people."
Yeah. Now, it turns out in this case, thankfully, it was actual law enforcement who turned them in. It's interesting how they discovered these posts. So the racist posts were discovered in July when a deputy was issued Owen's old computer, which he had left access to his Facebook account on. It's a bad idea when you're posting extremely racist memes and messages. So Sheriff Stephen D. Jessup, who was involved in the investigation, uncovered that. He was quoted as saying, "There was never any question of what I needed to do, and I did it. I do not tolerate that in my department," thankfully. Now, Owens, who now works as a police officer in Darien, yes, is still a police officer, declined to comment, and we can sort of understand why. But Geithner insisted just before he was fired. So Geithner was fired. Owens stepped down while the investigation was going on so that he could be hired in another precinct. Geithner said that the posts weren't serious and they weren't isolated incidents. It was just a joke. We all do it. Although an internal investigation showed that he was unable to provide any credible evidence that other deputies engaged in similar behavior, probably because they had put up passwords on their Facebook, and so they didn't have access to them. So thankfully, those two men, one was fired, one stepped down. But the reason, so JR pitched a story, and the reason why it's so timely is that we just had a vice presidential debate where they talked about implicit bias in police. And Mike Pence would have you believe, no, of course, no human, certainly no police officer, has any sort of implicit bias against any race. And then the next day we find out, yes, police officers were forced to step down or were fired as a result of racial targeting of one particular racial minority.
Talk about the systematic nature, because they're talking about the systematic nature of being a bias in police stations. Just in this story right now, he left his computer open and wide open and doing these things until where it was discovered. That showed how comfortable he was leaving it. If somebody's doing scandalous things, you don't want to get caught doing it. You probably have passwords on your things, or you make sure you erase that or take that away. People are like very particular about making sure they're not caught about things. But he's open because nobody's going to bother about it. Number two, the other guy still works as a cop, as we mentioned, so it doesn't matter. You can get another job somewhere else. I can keep being a racist. The guy who fired him, who found it, he had to explain, I saw it, and I had to, he has to, imagine the world we're living in, because he has to say, I saw it, and yes, I was going to fire him. Even in his own mind and doing the right thing, he's telling everybody, you know, I'm not going to let him stay on here. Because that's what we do. We let them stay on. It's a normal action to go, oh, okay, we'll give him some administrative leave. He'll stay on, put him on parking meters. I know that's the cliche thing to say. But put him on parking meters for a week, and he's back in. Because that's the way they normally do it. Yeah. It's like it's open in our face that they just let this stuff usually go.
Yeah,
I do want to give credit to Sheriff Stephen Jessup, as John was explaining. He had one more quote. He said, there's no joke about something like that, period. It's total racism. So if you're in the camp of, look, you got to trust the cops, well, good. Trust Sheriff Jessup. He says it's total racism.
Yeah, he said it made him want to vomit when he saw the messages.
Yeah, and so a great credit to him for pointing it out. You can't have these guys go out every single day looking for, as they say, nigs to bother, to harass. Because, look, if you were an actual police officer who just wanted to do your job without any bias, you would go out and see, okay, who's committing the crimes? They come in with a preconceived notion, whether you're committing crimes or not, I'm going to look for black people. Yeah. And by the way, if you're committing crimes and you're not black, I'm not even looking for you. Okay, that's a whole nother problem.
Yeah, certainly not if it's raining.
Yeah, and look, they say, hey, look, everybody did it. That might be true.
That might be true.
Right?
Yeah.
And so apparently Sheriff Jessup doesn't do it. At least he doesn't do it in open. So God bless his heart.
Yeah,
and so and once you at least fire one of those guys, another one resigns, it sends a message, well, maybe a lot of you do it, but you ought to think twice, because that's not the right way to do policing. You're supposed to serve the whole community.
I said, Georgia. Oh, Georgia. No peace I find. Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Well, Forsyth County Schools, a paraprofessional is out of a job this evening over comments that she made on social media. Jane Allen was a paraprofessional at Chastity Elementary School in Gainesville. She was fired after she posted negative and racially charged comments on Facebook about First Lady Michelle Obama, about immigrants and children with complex names. Forsyth County Schools say that they were made aware of the posts on Friday and then fired Allen today. A statement from the school district reads, in part, quote, racism and discrimination are not tolerated in our school district. We are committed to ongoing staff training on the acceptance of all individuals.
What are you doing here, nigga? I'm not gonna ask you again.
Young man, I've had a long day. I'm tired. But I'm not tired enough to ever let nobody call me that word. You see a nigga standing in front of you?
Dan Phillip, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you.
What is Nigger Rock? Describe it. Where is it, and why is it called that?
It is in Saint-Amand. This is about, an hour and a few minutes from Montreal. It used to be a slave area where they had slaves, mostly from the United States, who were escaping the Civil War and etc.
So they were former slaves?
When they came to Saint-Armand, they were also slaves because they came over there with their masters who continued the slave mentality of the black community. And there is a place they call Nigger Rock that black people who died were buried there in a mass grave. It is the result of which they refer to this area as Nigger Rock. As you know, at that time, people from the black community, slaves, were treated as niggers. And this is the name that was used traditionally to define people who were taken from Africa into the Americas and elsewhere.
Many people in Canada are under the impression that there were no slaves in Canada, that slavery did not exist here.
Well, history will tell us otherwise, and that is the reason why we want Nigger Rock to be recognized, so that we can know the full history. Quebec and Canada were involved in the slave trade. So we have two dimensions of history which must be explained to the entire population. Those who came here through the railway, underground railroad, and those who were brought here as slaves, who were treated as slaves and who continued to work and build this community and society as slaves. So this type of history must be known. The United Nations have already said it is necessary to give information to the entire population so that people would be able to know their history and understand where they come from, and to participate and to be able to speak of their history like everyone else. It is not appropriate for Canada to use history to please one group of people and deny others their full right, their full historical rights.
There is a group lobbying the Quebec Toponymy Commission at the moment. There are approximately 11 other sites around the province of Quebec that have this name, this designation, Nigger Rapids, etc., and many people find the word so offensive and want it changed. You do not want it changed at the Rock.
You know,
how about the other
not
sites?
I do want it changed. And, you know, like anybody else in the black community and elsewhere, I don't, agree to the word nigger or to refer to me as nigger and so on. I mean, it is a derogatory term, and it was used to degrade people, excuse me, from our community, etc. But we are dealing with a historical fact, and we are dealing with the age and the time. We cannot change history, we cannot change age, and we cannot change the time. So if we are going to use another word to define Nigger Rock, it will not deal with the time and the circumstances surrounding slavery at the time. So that is why I want the name to remain, so that we can refer to history in time, because we cannot change history.
So some of these other sites, you have no problem with the names being changed?
Because I have said, I spoke to the people responsible. What do you change it for? It is a question of history, and many places, not only here in Quebec and other places in Canada where they change the name, it is forgotten. It is not known. The The association with the name is gone. They change it to something else, and the place is forgotten. The history of the place is forgotten. The reason why it was named this way is forgotten. So, you know, when you deal with history, you must be able to respect the time that they referred to. If not, you are not dealing with time. It is like changing the name of any place, because there is a history behind the name. So this is why we object to it.
How would you like The Rock to be memorialized? It's on private property at this point.
Well, there are other private properties that are used to depict certain areas. As you know, in the United States, they are creating, or they have created, a museum which speaks of the history and the contributions of black people before and after slavery up to today. But here we have nothing to refer to, nothing to look back to, nothing. Our history is not only forgotten, but it is neglected. It isn't being taught in school, and most of us are not aware of slavery in Quebec and Canada. And, you know, I think this must be changed. If we have to be able to advance to the future, we must be able to know our past so that we can be stronger in dealing with our society. Our contributions must be known. Our sacrifices must be known. We must be known as builders of this society instead of being thought of as people who just come yesterday to take people's jobs. So it is a matter of pride for us. It is a matter of knowledge for us. It is a matter of being part of this society and feeling a sense of self and a sense of belonging. All these things are important to give value to our community and to our society. And indeed, the entire society should be aware of it so that they can be able to respect our contributions to the Quebec and Canadian societies.
Have you made your views clear to the Toponymy Commission?
Oh, I have. I have written to them. I have, even when they said that they were going to change the name, I gave them my objections and the objection of the Black Coalition and many in the community, because, as I said, we are dealing with history.
Is there any chance that there will be a plaque and that public can visit this site?
Oh, there's a plaque already. The government of Quebec established a plaque, and it can be seen at City Hall. But we want to go further than that. You know, I don't remember the date of the plaque, but we have it on our Facebook site. We are going to do everything to make it public, and we visit there every year to commemorate the area. We have pictures on our site and so on. And we will continue to do that.
When do you visit? What is that occasion?
Oh, generally it is to mark the transatlantic slave trade. We visit in order to make known the contributions. And this is before the 23rd of August, because, you know, the 23rd of August is the time or day that the United Nations designate as a day of remembrance dealing with the transatlantic slave trade. So we have a week of memorial and contributions, and we visit there as a remembrance of our ancestors who sacrificed over the years and to be able to remember. Because if we don't remember, then we are not being regarded as a people who really build this society.
Mr. Phillip, thank you for telling me about it.
It is I who must thank you.
Do you know what white folks call people like you and me in private? Niggers, dogs. Niggers.
Our big story at 10 tonight, a secret code for racists to be able to spread hate online is revealed.
The code is a way for social media users to be able to say whatever they want, spread their messages of hate without being censored.
The list of words surfacing tonight to replace things like Jew, Mexican, Arab, gay, lesbian, Democrats, and conservatives. And as Team 12's Monique Griego found out, it wouldn't be hard to accidentally retweet one. Monique?
Most of the words are pretty generic, so you could see a tweet or post online, share it with all your friends, and not even realize what you're really sending out. At first, they pop up like words out of place. Skittle, car salesman, Durden. But these tweets aren't typos.
The substitute words are meant to circumvent the system.
Carlos Galindo Hervida, the regional director for the Anti-Defamation League, talking about a new code of words being used by online communities to post racist, homophobic, and bigoted slurs without being censored.
They're meant to be coded, but to still deliver the impact that are intended.
Under the code, Skittles aren't just candies. They're Muslims or Arab. Jews are Skypes. Yahoo isn't just a search engine. It's Mexicans. And Google, that's the N-word. Different words delivering the same offensive message.
It is meant to cause pain. It is meant to be hurtful.
Google, Twitter, and Facebook, just some of the sites cracking down on cyber hate, which can include harassing posts, racist comments, or activity possibly linked to terrorism.
They're not trying to crack down on free speech or on people expressing their opinions. What I think they're responding to are words or incendiary language meant to create harm.
Still, most believe getting rid of all hate speech is an impossible task on the ever-changing internet.
While all social media sites have problems with harassment, when Twitter started losing a lot of users, many people thought it was because Twitter couldn't stop internet trolls from abusing people online. Monique Griego, 12 News at 10.
Now, and we want to warn you that some might find this next image in the story we're about to bring you offensive.
All right, let me set this up for you. Two Gaithersburg parents very upset at the response their 11-year-old got after he drew a lynching scene in a class assignment. Now, the sixth grader appears to have been making a social statement with the drawing, but a teacher and a counselor didn't really see it that way. WSA9's Stephanie Ramirez here with us, and the school sent him actually to be mentally evaluated.
Yeah, Adam, a Montgomery County School spokesperson says this was due to first miscommunication, then misinterpretation, and that the teacher was really just concerned for the sixth grader's well-being, but his parents feel like there was some ignorance here. I got to hear it all from the 11-year-old himself today after he got back from the Montgomery County Crisis Center.
I felt like I did something wrong, but as I come back home, my mom tells me I didn't do anything wrong, so I'm proud of this.
11-year-old Tajani Epps says he thought his assignment last Thursday for Banned Books Week was to draw something you didn't want to see anymore. So he drew a lynching to depict racism still existing in the United States. The drawing is titled Black Lives Matter.
Most people, because of what's going on in the world now, they're scared. And the little kids that are growing up, they shouldn't have to know that they lived around this.
I'm still a little angry at how things were handled.
Shade Green says her son never got to explain this and instead was pulled out of his classroom most of Friday, questioned, told to sign this contract for safety, promising not to harm himself, and then had to undergo a mental evaluation Monday. All because Green says the teacher saw this and thought suicide.
I kind of felt like, you know, it kind of rattled them a little bit, like especially coming from an 11-year-old. They didn't expect it. They didn't like it. And it just bothered them.
Green tells me the family talks about recent events, the shootings and protests, to help keep her son safe.
It's not just about Black Lives Matter. It's about all lives matter, you know, in a sense. But right now, that's what's going on, unfortunately.
It should send a message to all adults and saying that they should stop it and, like, need to do something about it.
Now, the school spokesperson also tells me that the teacher saw the assignment after, and that even after they realized what it was, that there was already a crisis plan in place, which is why it was suggested he go to the crisis center. The 11-year-old says he really just wants the chance to explain this all and have a conversation with the class. Adam, back to you.
All right, Stephanie, thank you. Now, Montgomery County Public Schools also says it's not a county issue, but a conversation the principal will have to have with his staff when school returns from holiday tomorrow. Now, we want to know what you think. Head over to our WSA9 Facebook page and leave us your comments and thoughts.
Well, Haiti is on the list of what's supposed to be. Haiti, the people who are called Haitians, predominantly are people who are classified as non-white. So they're not supposed to ever have anything under the system of white supremacy except punishment
yeah.
for being arrogant enough under Toussaint to think that you, with your military skills, can take us over or tell us what to do. So many a historian has said that the reason Haiti is in the shape that it's in now, and sort of like the head wagon people of the world, you might say,
mm-hmm.
everybody kind of looks on them with great pity. It's because the white supremacists made that decision.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to make examples of you. Don't you ever think that you can have military force against me, us white supremacists of the world.
The hurricane left hundreds of people dead in Haiti, and the president there is calling the situation in the southwest of his country a catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands lost homes or crops. Many lost everything. Survivors are growing frustrated. They're worried they may not get any help. NPR's Jason Bobian reports from the port city of Lakai.
We're in a high school in Lakai right now, and this is one of the places that was designated as a shelter before the storm. And a lot of these people moved in before. Some people came right after the storm actually hit. And right now it is packed with people. There's laundry hanging from every spare space, a balcony along here. And the other thing is that people are incredibly frustrated. People don't know when they're going to be able to move back into their homes. A lot of people are injured. There are a lot of people right in front of me with bandages on their head, on their arms, people with gashes on their feet. Across town, a large crowd has gathered around a truck that people heard might be loaded with food aid. Young, muscled men shove the crowd away from the vehicle. People are trying to get on with their lives here. Amidst the felled power lines and destroyed buildings, street vendors have gone back to selling mangoes and fried plantains. Stores have reopened. Despite this attempt towards normalcy, aid agencies say the needs here are huge. Hundreds of thousands of people had their homes partially or totally destroyed. Crops have been wiped out.
Let's use this.
At the main public hospital in Lakai, Dr. Lance Plyler from the Christian aid group Samaritan's Purse today was bandaging a 3-year-old boy's broken ankle. Dr. Plyler had just stopped by the hospital. There was no one to attend to the boy, so he ended up bandaging the boy's leg in the parking lot between two cars.
This kid's got a broken and infected leg. We're just putting a Band-Aid on a big problem, but we're trying to hopefully just, you know, arrest the infection enough that he'll be okay.
This hospital is still struggling to reopen. The 156-bed facility today could only take 10 patients. Most of the staff who could make it to work were busy trying to clear debris from the compound and mop mud out of the wards. Gilbert Lorcy is one of the people who didn't lose his roof. His tin roof and wooden rafters blew off in the Category 4 hurricane. They were able to pick it back up, however, and prop it up on what was left of his stone walls. During the day, Lorcy and his family of five camp out under it. Then at night, they go to sleep in a shelter. His neighbor next door is doing the same thing.
As now, we have nothing to cope with the situation. So we spend the day in our yard, but every night we go in a shelter for 2 or 3 days. We believe that they will host us, but later on we'll have like to find like a way to address a proper living.
Lorcy says he doesn't have a plan. He has no money to rebuild, but he also doesn't have anywhere else to go. He hopes the government or aid groups will provide building materials so that he can reconstruct his house. His neighbor worries that if aid does arrive, it won't go to people like Lorcy. Haitians have far too much experience as aid recipients. These men worry that the relief will go to people who are better connected, better off, or stronger than they are. Jason Bobien, NPR News.
Haiti has the lowest
paid hourly wage in the entire Western Hemisphere. Aristide was trying to win for these people just before he was thrown out, taken out, kidnapped. $2 a day. These are the people who work in the sweatshops, Fruit of the Loom, Hanes, Levi's, all of those major companies. The lowest hourly wage in the Western Hemisphere. Trying to raise that wage from 24 cents to 61 cents, or $5 a day. The factory owners, combined with USAID, the U.S. Embassy, and Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, to squelch that for Haiti.
Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton spent much of the day in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's where Keith Lamont Scott was shot and killed by police nearly 2 weeks ago. That shooting exposed tensions between Charlotte's black community and the police and brought days of protest. NPR's Asma Khalid is traveling with the Clinton campaign in Charlotte. Hi, Asma.
Hi, Michelle.
So tell us, why did Hillary Clinton decide to go to Charlotte today?
Well, Michelle, this is actually a trip she had planned for last weekend, but it got postponed. She wanted to come and show solidarity with the African-American community in the aftermath of that shooting you mentioned of Keith Lamont Scott, and city officials had asked her to wait. So this morning she came, she joined the congregation at Little Rock AME Zion Church in Charlotte, and she began by specifically talking about Scott's death and said that this type of violence has happened far too frequently in the African-American community. You know, she talked about praying for peace when there is so much violence outside the church walls, and she tried to empathize with members of the congregation, show that she understands the fear and frustration in the black community. But, Michelle, I think what was most interesting about all of her remarks today was that she had some real talk and a recognition of her own privilege. You know, she loves to talk about being a grandmother, and she did that here today, but in a different way.
I'm a grandmother, and like every grandmother, I worry about the safety and security of my grandchildren. But my worries are not the same as black grandmothers.
So, Asma, how were her remarks received? I can hear a lot of people kind of expressing what seemed to be kind of verbal assent. Did her remarks seem to go over well?
They did seem to go over really well. She got a number of applause lines when she spoke about the need to, you know, empathize and understand where some African-Americans are coming from, and also about the need for police forces to perhaps de-escalate some tense situations.
So, Asma, since we are just really a couple of weeks out from the election, did Hillary Clinton talk politics in any explicit way?
Yeah, you know, Michelle, this was also, you know, no doubt a political message. And she did talk about President Obama and her desire to build on the work that he's done. She also explicitly told the congregation that in light of the protests the city has seen recently, that voting is a part of pushing for change.
Not everyone can march, but everyone can talk. And everyone can reach out. And everyone can vote.
Now, Asma, the African-American vote has been seen as something of a firewall for Secretary Clinton around the country, but I would imagine that it is particularly critical in a state like North Carolina. Can you tell us more about that?
It is. Black voters are key to Clinton's strategy here. About a quarter of the electorate is African-American, and those who vote are loyal Democrats. But there are some questions about black turnout this year. And, you know, black turnout was at record levels during the Obama years. And there are some questions about whether Hillary Clinton can match that. She was here today in part to empathize with the community because of the recent police shootings. But she was also here in part to solidify the Democratic base and ensuring that African-Americans here in North Carolina show up on election day.
That's NPR's Asma Khalid traveling with Hillary Clinton's campaign in Charlotte, North Carolina. Asma, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
I've seen what's around the corner. I've seen what's over the horizon. And I promise you, you niggas have nothing to celebrate. And no, I won't get there with you. I'm going to Canada.
I was walking down the street. I was taking the streetcar, let me correct myself, down the street, as one does if one is in downtown Toronto, and I was going to a Blue Jays game, as one does in the city of Toronto when one is gifted tickets, as I was. And so it is not uncommon when I am riding on the street car for me to gaze longingly out the window. And that's what I was doing when I happened to see something that I really wish I had not seen. This was on Tuesday of the week that just passed. So I'm riding southbound, and I'm just north of Dundas. And I look out the window, and on the east side of the street, I can see a man. And this man is young. He is black. And he looks terrified. He's standing, and he's got his back up against the window of a storefront. His hands are in the air, and he's surrounded by police officers. Anybody who watches TV, who checks out our videos on News Talk 1010, this is a sight that has become all too common for us, to see a young black man, or sometimes not a so young black man, surrounded by police, a black woman surrounded by police, black people being accosted by police. I had no clue what was going on except for what I could see, but I wanted to find out. You know, I'm a journalist. I've been writing for several years for publications like the Toronto Star. And when I got out of that streetcar in haste, I didn't think that I was going to be writing a story. I just wanted to see if a black person who seemed like they were terrified was okay. Because that's what I believe in. I think that we should all be doing that, knowing the crisis that we have in policing in North America, knowing the fact that we have this practice of police carding where police are arbitrarily stopping people, especially those who are black. I wanted to find out what was going on. And I can tell you, and I want to tell you, before I go on with this story, that almost no one who saw what was going on the street stopped to check out what was happening. It was as if it was invisible to them. I think that there's something wrong with that, but I digress. This young man was standing with his hands up, very scared, surrounded by at least 6 or 7 police officers, and more were arriving during the time that I was there and milling about the scene. It was very clear that this young man was being questioned by the police at length, and that they were running his name in their computer. I could see this because an officer was going towards his car into the computer, and he was asking the young man questions, specifically questions about his address, questions about his middle name. And there was some back and forth as if the police officer was doubting the answers that this young man was giving him about his identity. I heard this man say multiple times, "Why are you doing this to me? Why are you making this about me? I'm the one who called you guys. I'm the one who called you. Why are you treating me like this?" So this man had called 911 and the police had showed up, and now he was there being questioned and detained and having his name run through a police database. A police officer that was closest to this man bent over and he picked up the man's backpack. He began going through the man's backpack right there on the street for everybody to see. And when he was done that, the officer put the backpack down. And without any warning whatsoever, he reached his hands out and began groping around this man's crotch and pocket area, searching him right out in the middle of the street without any warning whatsoever. I want you to imagine that happening to you. You call the police because you have an emergency, and you end up standing there surrounded by police in a public street while the police grope your crotch. I was shocked when I saw this. And when I saw the police officer touching this young man, I called out to him and I said, "Hey, if you don't want this police officer to be touching you right now, You should really let him know that. Tell him that you don't want to be searched. And the reason I said this, of course, is because we always have a right to tell the police that we don't wish to be searched. We always have that right. We always have the right to not talk to the police, to remain silent, as they like to say on the TV shows. We always have those rights, no matter what is going on, unless we are under arrest. And it didn't appear to me that this man was under arrest. So I let him know, you can decide to tell the police, please don't search me. As soon as I said this, the attention of these several officers turned from this young black man who was standing on the street to me. One of the officers, the one who had been searching him, became quite upset. And he came over and started questioning and interrogating me. And I decided to put my camera phone on my cell phone, because I didn't want whatever was going on to this young man to happen to me. And I figured that filming the interaction would keep me safe. Well, that officer saw me take out my phone and begin filming him. And he proceeded to come over to where I was standing. He had to walk several feet to get over to where I was, because I wasn't anywhere close to him. And he reached out and he tried to grab my phone out of my hand. I got it on tape. You know, this frustrated me a lot, and I wrote a story about this in the Toronto Star this week. I didn't talk a whole lot about what happened to me, and the reason I didn't talk about that in the story is because I wanted the focus to be on this young man and the way that the police, the disgraceful way that our police treated a person who called them for help. But I can tell you that I asked police communications to explain why a police officer would come up to a civilian on the street who was filming them and try to take away their personal property in the form of my cell phone. Do you know what police communications said? This is a quote. This is the specific answer that I was given. After it was confirmed that there were no weapons and that the subject was the victim, the officers did not want a video of a victim publicized. That's an official answer from the Toronto Police about why their officer tried to steal my phone from me. There's something called the OIPRD, the Ontario Independent Review of Police Directorate. I will be filing a complaint. And if you're out there listening, don't you ever let the police intimidate you into believing that you don't have the right to film them in public. Because as long as you're not stopping them from doing their job, you absolutely have that right. And I think sometimes you have the responsibility knowing how rogue our police are acting out in these streets.
1 out of 4 human beings with their hands on bars, shackled, in the world, are locked up here in the land of the free.
Khalif Browder was walking home from a party when he was stopped by police.
They said, we're going to take you to the precinct, and most likely we're going to let you go home. And then I never went home.
13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. There are exceptions, including criminals.
The loophole was immediately exploited. What you got after that was a rapid transition to a mythology of black criminality.
Some people got the real problem.
Animals, beasts that needed to be controlled.
You better believe it.
I'm only human.
It became virtually impossible for a politician to run and appear soft on crime.
The kinds of kids that are called super predators.
Millions of dollars will be allocated for prison and jail facilities.
3 strikes and you are out.
It was an enormous burden on the black community, but it also violated a sense of core fairness.
Some people got the real problem.
States were required to keep these prisons filled, even if nobody was committing a crime.
It's so difficult to talk about mass incarceration because it has become heavily monetized.
I'm only human.
The focus is on taking people from prison, putting them in community corrections, parole, and probation.
How much progress is it really if now there's a private company making money off the GPS monitor?
Now have more African Americans under criminal supervision than all the slaves back in the 1850s.
I'm only human after
We are the products of the history that our ancestors chose. Products of that set of choices that we have to understand in order to escape from it. We should go looking somewhere
high. I'm only human after all, don't put the blame on me.
That was the trailer for Ava DuVernay's new film, 13th. It will be released by Netflix on Friday. The United States accounts for 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. In 2014, more than 2 million people were incarcerated in the United States. Of those, 40% were African-American men. According to the Sentencing Project, African-American males born today have a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison in their lifetimes if incarceration trends continue. Well, on Saturday, I had a chance to sit down with the acclaimed director, Ava DuVernay, after the Friday night premiere of her new documentary, 13th. Again, the first time a documentary opened the New York Film Festival. DuVernay's previous work includes the hit 2014 film Selma, which told the story of the campaign led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others to draw the nation's attention to the struggle for equal voting rights by marching from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, in March of 1965. With Selma, Ava DuVernay became the first African-American woman director to have a film nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. As we sat down together on Saturday, I began by asking Ava DuVernay about the significance of the film's title, 13th.
13th is the jumping-off point for a conversation, a wide-ranging conversation that gives you a tour through the history of racism, oppression, and subjugation in this country of black people as it relates to the criminal justice system. 13th is speaking about the 13th Amendment, specifically the criminality clause, which states that slavery is abolished in this country except if we decide that you're a criminal.
And what does that mean from 1865, when the 13th Amendment was passed, to today?
Well, that's what the 13th explores. We take you from 1865 and the abolition of slavery and the enactment of the 13th Amendment all the way to now in this Black Lives Matter movement. And we trace decade by decade, generation by generation, politician by politician, president by president, each decision and how it has led to this moment. And we try to give, you know, gosh, some historical context to what is happening now. You know, I think people get in this present moment and they start to forget that we're part of a legacy. And this legacy is rich, but it's also very violent. And so we try to kind of get into the deep layers in this film.
Let's go to a clip of 13th.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. In other words, it grants freedom to all Americans. There are exceptions, including criminals.
There's a clause, a loophole.
If you have that embedded in the structure, in this constitutional language, then it's there to be used as a tool for whichever purposes one wants to use it.
That's a clip from 13th, Ava DuVernay's film. How did you go from Selma, the blockbuster feature film, to choosing to make this documentary, which opened the New York Film Festival, first time ever a documentary opened this film festival in over, what, half a century?
Yeah. You know, it's not the typical decision that you would make after Selma. But I don't have any precedent. There's no black woman I can ask about what's the right decision here because you've done it before in terms of being a black woman filmmaker. So I'm kind of trying to create my own path there. A lot of beautiful black women filmmakers, but none that have been in the position where, unfortunately, they've had to kind of decide what to do next after a film that got as much attention as Selma. And so for me, I thought there can't be a wrong decision. I'm not going to do what my white male counterparts might do. I'm going to do what feels right to me. And so when Netflix said, would you like to make a documentary about anything, we'll pay for it. I always knew that I wanted to explore this issue. And so it seemed like a perfect time.
I mean, the power of this film And you go from president to president. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing you at Sundance when you talked about showing the film to the first African-American president mm-hmm. in White House 100 years after another president viewed a film there. And that film is in this film.
Right. D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation is a great, jumping off point to talk about the immersion that we as Americans have had with images that show black men, black people as criminals, because it really and truly started with that film. Started with that film in a way that it was using the power of the cinematic image to subjugate, to turn the tide, to change opinion. You know, D.W. Griffith was a masterful filmmaker. He used a lot of techniques that we still use today. He innovated them. He invented them. Too bad he was a racist, because all of those tools that he was using was used to make people think that other people think that people like me are less than they are.
And President Wilson's response?
That the film was history written in lightning.
That there was nothing more true.
That's right.
1915.
That's right.
So let's talk about the presidential candidates mm-hmm. of today. Your mm-hmm. film does not start and end with these candidates, but it does refer to them. Talk about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Well, it's interesting that the two candidates are in the film, but not really specifically about their candidacy. Oddly enough, both of these public figures have touched on this issue in their public life. And so we basically are eliminating that. Donald Trump and his comments and his call for death of the Central Park Five, taking out an ad, really being in the forefront of that issue, fits into a section where we talk about media imagery and the insidious nature of the slanted media imagery. And then Mrs. Clinton, with comments that she made about super predators, comments that she's made about reversing that, her husband's legislation in the 1994 crime bill, her support of that at the time. So they are embedded in the documentary in a historical context, not even speaking of them as candidates. We do have a section where we show Mr. Trump and some of his rallies, and we put imagery that I believe he is evoking against his words in the rallies. So in one of the rallies, he talks about the good old days when people were ripped from their seats and taken out in stretchers. And then we show you images of the good old days when black people sitting at lunch counters trying to desegregate were ripped from their seats and taken out in stretchers. And so they're both there. And hopefully people can interrogate the candidates more deeply than I think we as not your viewers, but most of the public is really giving them a pass because we're so embroiled in Twitter beefs and nonsense and not asking about the issues.
And this film, 13th, coming out in this pivotal election season. How do you hope it will affect the election?
I hope that people demand answers, demand some strategy, demand a plan. Neither one of them has really talked in a great detail or enough detail for me as to what their feelings are about this issue in a way that is going to make long-term change. It's a lot of cosmetic talk, but I'm really interested in a full commitment to making change. And that can only happen if people demand it.
And your, finally, focus on the many different people you interview, a centerpiece is Michelle Alexander.
Oh, yes.
Talk about her significance and Angela Davis's in this last minute.
Well, you know, Queen Angela Davis, to be able to sit down with her, you know, one of the architects of the prison abolitionist movement, one of the first people to, really found the term prison industrial complex, all her work in this space long before it became the issue of the moment. And so to sit down with her and have a wide-ranging conversation is elevating in every sense. And so she's a big part of the fabric of the documentary. Michelle Alexander, her work, so foundational to a lot of our thinking about this now, and really trying to take a lot of what she educates and opens eyes to and take it further in the documentary. And so she was gracious, not further in a negative way, but just to continue with that line of thought. And so she was gracious enough to sit down and give us a wonderful interview. I flew out to see her at where she teaches. And it was she's a big, big part, a big voice in this doc, as is Brian Stevenson and Khalil Muhammad and Kevin Gannon and Malkia Cyril. A lot of really, really wonderful people who are just sharing their hearts in this. And hopefully people will feel that.
Ava, finally, what gives you hope?
Oh, gosh. the faces of black people whenever I come, whenever I see them, because there's black joy amidst all of the black trauma. You know, all of the years of violence and oppression, subjugation, prejudice, all of the years of not being able to live fully free in this country as full citizens with all the rights and freedoms. It is, there's still joy there. There's a survival there that still allows for there to be a light. And that is such a strength. That is such a beauty that whenever I see black people gathered, more than one, it gives me hope.
That was Ava DuVernay, director of the new documentary, 13th. Again, it's the first documentary ever to open the New York Film Festival to rave reviews and standing ovations. Let's turn to another clip of 13th.
War on drugs had become part of our popular culture in television programs like Cops.
When you cut on your local news at night, you see black men being paraded across the screen in handcuffs.
Black people, black men and black people in general, are overrepresented in news as criminals. When I say overrepresented, that means they are shown as criminals more times than is accurate that they are actually criminals, right? Based on FBI statistics.
I mean, I'm a big believer in the power of media full of these cliches that basically present mostly black and brown folks who seem like animals in cages. And then someone could turn off the TV thinking, it's a good thing for prisons, because otherwise those crazy people would be walking on my block.
Creating a context where people are afraid. And when you make people afraid, you can always justify putting people in a garbage can.
Chances are you could run into a kid waiting to relieve you of your purse or wallet.
Every media outlet in the country thinks I'm less than human. I began to hear the word super predator as if that was my name.
Super predator, predator.
Super predator.
Super predators. End quote. That's the word they use to describe this generation. And it was very, very effective.
Experts call them super predators.
They are not just gangs of kids anymore. They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy.
Animals, beasts that needed to be controlled.
When those grandmothers say, but he's a good boy. He never did anything. Don't you believe it?
Many black communities began to actually support policies that criminalize their own children.
Last night, the 18s accused in the attack were arraigned on charges of rape and attempted murder.
In the Central Park Jagger case, they put five innocent teens in prison because the public pressure to lock up these quote-unquote animals was so strong.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it.
Donald Trump wanted to give these kids a death penalty, and he took out a full-page ad to put the pressure on. These children, four of them under 18, all went to adult prisons for 6 to 11 years before DNA evidence proved they were all innocent.
How'd you like to live like a king, using them fists of yours? We got some bad boys. Was pretty good with their hands. And they're making money in here. Good-ass money. I want you to get in on this. Believe it or not, it'll benefit both of us. I get a little extra coin, and you, if you survive, get to be your own man. Untouched. Extra rations, maybe a conjugal or two. It's a good offer, convict.
Slavery was always a good offer. To a master.
We are joined right now by Mumia Abu-Jamal, who just called in from prison in Pennsylvania. Mumia, we did not expect this call. The last time we had you on, Mumia, a federal judge denied a request for you to get life-saving medication that could cure your hepatitis C. Can you talk about your health right now and what's happening?
Well, you have to admit, against your better judgment, perhaps, but it's damn good entertainment, and it's unbelievable. I mean, this is the ultimate reality show. It's so real, it's unreal. I think it reflects clearer than anything we could have imagined the fall of empire. And, you know, this is how democracies fall. History repeats itself. First time is tragedy. Second time is farce. So it's interesting. It's entertaining. It's unbelievable. Yet here we are.
The last time we had you on, Mumia, a federal judge denied a request for you to get life-saving medication that could cure your hepatitis C. Can you talk about your health right now and what's happening?
Well, this is one of my itchy days. So despite taking anti-itch medication, the itchiness has re-flared. And so it's not a good day. It's not a comfortable day. We kind of got a situation where the judge, I think, performed a Solomonic act in breaking the baby in half. The judge did rule that the protocol of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections was unconstitutional and a violation of the Constitution, and deliberate indifference to the medical needs of at least 6,000 people in Pennsylvania prisons. He reasoned also that I had sued DOC officials, and that was a violation of what he called sovereign immunity. We respectfully disagreed, but he said what we should have sued was something called the Hepatitis C Care Committee. The fact is, until we had our hearing, we did not know that such a committee existed. So it would have been kind of magical to kind of stop the hearing and say, okay, what are the names of the people of this committee? We want a real, you know, refile against them. Because we learned about it on perhaps the third or the fourth day of our temporary restraining order hearing. Yet our lawyers, being very apt and very able, Brett Grote and Bob Boyle, refiled against the Hepatitis C Care Committee, but also refiled against the DOC defendants, because they had an opportunity as administrators and healthcare officials to say, no, treat this man. They said, no, go by the protocol. And the protocol that was declared unconstitutional on August 31st is still the one in place as of today. So it's still unconstitutional.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, mass incarceration is a major issue in this country today. I just came from the premiere of the documentary by Ava DuVernay called 13th, about the 13th Amendment, slavery of 1865, and mass incarceration today. Your thoughts behind bars?
Well, it is, remember I talked about tragedy and farce a few moments ago? It is a tragedy that we're now counting down the days of the first African-American, accent on African, president in the history of the United States. And when he leaves, you will still have the greatest incarcerator on earth at work and growing and continuing to divest and destroy and diminish the lives of millions of people. The fact that you could have a black presidency and not put a dent in that hellhole is startling, is tragedy, on, you know, on a grand stage.
President, and yet President Obama is the first sitting president to go into a prison.
Yeah, he went into a prison that was empty because all of the prisoners were emptied from their cells. So he walked into a prison block. Yes, that's true, and it's historic. But it's also true that he walked in an empty prison block. If you have the greatest incarceration on earth in this nation, then, you know, why don't you make history by attacking not empty cells, but creating empty cells by freeing people? And it is a tragedy, because if you think one of the architects, or at least a great mind that helped the architect, and I speak now of William Jefferson Clinton, if you think that his wife will destroy what he is proud of, right, then you're tripping. I mean, this is not a good time to be black in America, and not just because of people walking while black, driving while black, running while black, breathing while black, but because of all of the hells that people suffer all across America. And the truth of the matter is, it ain't getting sweeter. It ain't getting better.
Mumia, it's the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panthers in just a few weeks. Your comments on this as a former Black Panther yourself?
I am happy to announce that we are republishing We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party, by a new publisher called Common Notions of Brooklyn. It's a book that I'm really proudest of, because it tells the story of the Black Panther Party, warts and all, criticisms and all, personal and political. And I think that in an age where Black Lives Matter is the greatest and biggest civil rights movement in decades, it's time for people to learn from that movement, its high points, its low points, its mistakes, and its successes. Because if you read the 10-point program that Bobby Seale and Huey P. Newton wrote in October 1966, it will startle you. It will shock you to see what hasn't changed in 50 years. To quote Young Jeezy, the rapper, we're still living in hell. And so we must change this reality. And that work continues for all of us.
Ladies and gentlemen, Nate Parker's in the building.
What's up? What's up?
Two things I thought I would never see on a Hollywood screen is Luke Cage in any form and Nat Turner in a movie. Right. I've been screaming for a Nat Turner movie because I don't like slave movies. Mm-hmm. I've been denounced them. I said, if you're going to make any slave movie, let it be Nat Turner, because Nat Turner wasn't a victim. That's right. And you got it done.
Well, let's explain Nat Turner, too, for people that don't know, because I've never learned it in my history books. It wasn't anything that I've ever read. And
right.
I went to Hampton University, which is HBCU. I've been in Hampton. I know you're from Norfolk. Mm-hmm. So what made that so special to you, that story?
Well, a lot of it is what you just said. I grew up in Norfolk, 42 miles east of Southampton County, where the revolt happened, and I never heard about this brother, right?
So really?
Yeah, I never heard about him. We
learned about it growing up, but... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never learned about it in school. Mm-hmm. And it's significant, because when you think of the proximity, you would think that someone would have said something. Mm-hmm. But it speaks to the danger of the revolutionary, you know, the person that looks like us that fought for his own freedom. We don't get those stories. Like you said, you know what I mean? Like, even when we learn about slavery, we learn through the context.
Context.
Looking at behavior context.
Stuff.
The victim.
A victim. And we laid down until Honest Abe said enough is enough. You know, Honest Abe couldn't tell a lie, molding his chin. Pensive, the slave problem, we got to figure it out. Pick us up, and now we're free.
Right.
You know, we don't learn about, you know, Toussaint. We don't learn about Denmark Vesey. We don't learn about Gabriel Prosser. We don't learn about any of them, right? And so you have to ask yourself, why is that? Why is our history being hid? The things that would empower us, you know what I mean? And I mean, even when I was trying to make this film, people were like, if you make this film, bro, like, it's going to be a problem. Like, don't make this film. Like, black people, like, prominent directors was like, make the story of John Brown. You know, John Brown's a white abolitionist that led a slave revolt. Mm-hmm. It was like, that'll be easier for people to digest. You know what I mean? I had another prominent black director told me, he was like, well, I liked your script, but I didn't love it. One thing would have made me love it. And I was like, what? You know, I got my notebook out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he said, you need more good white people.
Wow.
I was like, what do you mean? He was like, white people ain't going to watch that, man. Ain't going to watch that shit.
But it was the 1800s. It's a period piece.
And it was America.
White people evil, right.
But that's what I'm saying. And it was America. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, when it comes to other demographics that have endured torture and genocide and Holocaust, you know, it's never forget. You know what I mean? It's very important that we hold those stories up so they never repeat themselves. But in this country, we have this habit of kind of closing off the things that don't reflect us in the best of lights. You know, so in telling the story, you know, I said, man, I learned about Nat Turner at 21, but if I'd have learned about him at 12.
How did you learn about him at 21?
African-American studies class. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Like, they made you read The Confessions of Nat Turner? Or?
I did read that.
Okay.
You know, and it's funny because Confessions is fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like a...
I always wondered about that. Somebody told me that before.
It won a Pulitzer, which is tricky because it won the Pulitzer for fiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when people talk about it, because it's like the end all, you know what I mean? But even, you know, the writer, he said it's a reimagining of Nat Turner's life. It's not Nat Turner's life. So when you read The Fires of Jubilee, you know, or William Drury's book, Southampton Insurrection, and you read the real stuff, you're like, wait a minute.
Well, I need to read the real stuff. The only thing I ever read was The Confessions of Nat Turner.
But I'm going to tell you, how, like, it's a fiction book where it said, okay, well, Nat Turner, he is all of his motivation came for his lust after the handmaid of his master, like a white woman. Like, that's why. And he was crazy. He was a fanatic. Mm-hmm. He was homosexual. Like, all these things that they made up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So when you get to the real, you're like, well, why would they denigrate his life? Why would they mysticize the things that actually happened when mm-hmm. they had, like, why would they make it so he didn't have children or didn't have a wife?
Mm-hmm.
When in real life, he had a wife, he had a child. You know what I'm saying? Right. So it's like the attack, you know, of the black man, the demonizing of the black man is something that ain't new. This right. is age old,
mm-hmm.
you know? So when we get to celebrate this story, you know, like I said, you know, a lot of people I grew up with went to prison, did, you know, not here with us today,
mm-hmm.
had that chip on their shoulder and had no context as to why or where, you know, they could put that energy. But heroes, when you can say, oh, no, Nat Turner rose and stood so I can stand.
Nat Turner was Django before Django.
The real Django.
Yeah, me and Chris Rock had a debate about that because he thought I was trying to insult Nat Turner by saying that. But the reason I love Django is because he wasn't a victim. Django burnt the plantation
He
down.
Did. And he stood up and he was like, nah, it's not happening this way. I'll take it even a step further, though. Nat Turner said, I'm going to sacrifice on behalf of people that I'll never meet.
Mm.
You get what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, and biblically it says a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Right? Nat Turner was like, okay, I'm going to walk to these gallows, but mm-hmm. I know that what I did will echo into eternity. We're right. celebrating that turn. They skinned him, made lampshades out of his skin and purses. Like, this is mm-hmm. what they did.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying? So it's like all, and they did what they did in the name of God. He did what he did in the name of God. Because it ain't, for me, it ain't about the money. It ain't about no accolades. It ain't, I didn't step away from acting and bankrupt my life and put my mortgage in jeopardy just, you know, to be fly. Mm-hmm. You know, like, that's not what this is about. This is about a story that if I had when I was 12, I mean, we lose young brothers and sisters 11, 12. Yeah. They don't have heroes and people that I to connect to. Now, to be have a kid on the playground saying, well, I'm Nat Turner, like, it's priceless.
I learned about Denmark VC at about 13, 14, mm. because I'm from Monk's Corner, South Carolina, but born in Charleston.
Yes.
So they would take us to field trips to Denmark VC's house.
Right.
So I knew about Denmark VC since decades ago.
But what does that do for your self-esteem when someone says black people didn't fight? You're like, wait, no. Let's get this straight right now. And what we're working on right now is like a monument for Nat Turner. There's things we're trying to put together. So a field trip. So my young 11-year-old self in Norfolk at Tidewater Park or Ruffner Middle School get on a bus. They take me to Southampton County, 40 miles away, and they say, everyone, this is the path that Nat Turner took with his rebels when they were fighting for the liberation that you enjoy. And all of a sudden, you, in the same way, you ever meet like a strong, proud, like Irish person or a strong, proud Scottish person. They have the crest tattooed mm-hmm. on their arms.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like we do that. Like we know when you learn about Hannibal, you learn about, you know, Timbuktu or Kush mm-hmm. or Ashanti, all of that. It does something for your self-esteem.
Right.
But we've been so disconnected from Africa that it's like we can't even attach to the Moors. We can't even attach to the people that came before us, our ancestors that did great things because when we were kids, and we're probably some of us near the same age, in between commercials, they were giving us Sally Struthers for 70 cents a day. You can help one of these little skinny, pot-belly flies walk under their eyes, in and out of their mouth. You know what I'm saying?
But Norfolk was so racist when you were down there. I mean,
right.
Virginia, especially that area where you're
Absolutely.
From over there, it was so racist. I mean, they still fly the Confederate flag. I mean,
That's
I went
right.
to school down
same
there.
Same thing in South Carolina.
And, right. and it's still so nasty. So how did you even overcome all of that? That Hampton Roads area down there is nasty.
It's
over
tough.
There, you know,
it's
when
tough.
I went to school down there.
Right. You know, well, overcome it, you mean in the sense of making the film or
right.
just.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I went down there for my research. I don't do well with fear. I don't fear anything.
Well, you're a wrestler. I've been watching your wrestling.
Right.
Team,
yeah.
You're busy wrestling.
I did all right. So for me, it's like I don't look at it through the lens of like what people might do to me or how people feel. I look at it through the lens of like how we've been conditioned to see ourselves and how I may be a part of the solution
right.
to change the narrative around who we are as a people.
Right. And even watching this afterwards, you feel like you can apply a lot of different things to what's going on.
That's right.
Even today, I walked out of there and I was like, wow, there's just so many things that you see
mm-hmm.
when you watch Birth of a Nation, that mm-hmm. what's going on in the news today, what's going on in the communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that you were on T.D. Jakes
mm-hmm.
and you spoke about the first police officers were mm-hmm. overseers.
That's right. Well, yeah, first police officers were slave catchers. They were called patty rollers.
Who you belong to, boy?
Yeah, they go straight. They go through the plantation. It's funny how, like, when you have context, you just think differently, right? Mm-hmm. So look, the first police officers, right, I want to say in South Carolina, their job was to go in between the plantations and make sure nobody was wandering or deserted or ran. And if they caught someone, sometimes they just kill them. Or sometimes they bring them back and beat them publicly, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you fast forward to 2016, you look at our communities, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of times in our communities, we're fine. But if you could drop, I mean, no, I came up Tidewater Park. Mm-hmm. In Tidewater Park, you're in between that. I mean, there's people that haven't left the neighborhood mm-hmm. in years. Why? Mm-hmm. What happens if you leave the plantation? That's, as soon as you cross that street, you're pulled over. Mm-hmm. Where are you going? Where's your past?
What you doing in this neighborhood? Mm-hmm.
What you doing in this neighborhood? Mm-hmm. Right? So if we can understand the damaged relationship between us and law enforcement back then we have context as to right now in 2016. And we're not saying, oh, a couple bad apples. We're saying, no, something systemic has happened.
Direct correlation.
Direct correlation. You're
driving the wrong neighborhood if you want to as a black man. See if they don't ask you for your past.
Yeah, if they don't ask you for your past. And then get out of the car, get the F on the curb. Mm-hmm. That's the game. You know, but if you have that context, right, then you can deal with it in a way that's made more progressive rather than saying there are a couple bad cops. You know, I for one, and people may disagree with this, I don't think a cop wakes up and says, man, I hope I can kill me today. Excuse my language. Mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, but they're taught and conditioned to believe. Absolutely. Black ones and white ones, mm-hmm. taught and conditioned to believe that when you see someone of color, they are presumed dangerous and guilty.
A bad guy.
Yeah.
A bad guy. Mm-hmm. Dangerous. Or they call it criminal policing. I had a police tell me, he was like, dude, we're in the good neighborhoods. That is administrative policing. You know what I'm saying? We see someone, hello, how are you, sir? How are you, ma'am? Can you please? He was like, but when we in the jungle, and he said the word jungle, but just because it's like in him, it's the mm-hmm. hunt. It's criminal policing. You know, you on probation. You know what I'm saying? You're on parole. Get on the curb.
All right.
But it's a mentality. And that same mentality says, make it home no matter what.
Right.
Protect yourself no matter what. All of that is passed down. All that fear, like all of this trauma that we're feeling is directly connected to the worst period in American history that we do like this. Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. But I got a lot to be mad about. Got a lot to be a man about. Got a lot to pop a sand about. I used to rock hammer downs. And rock standing crowds, but it's hard when you only got fans around and no fam around. And if they all, then they hands is out and they pointing fingers. When I wear this fucking burden on my back like a motherfucking cap and gown, then I walk up in the bank, pants sag it down, and I laugh at frowns. What they mad about? Cause here come this motherfucker with this mass account that didn't wear a cap and gown. Are you mad cause the judge ain't give me more time? And when I tipped the suicide, I didn't die. I remember how mad I was on that day, man. You gotta let it go before I get up in the way. Let it go, let it go.
Ran into this girl, she said, why you always stay? Can't just face it. Why you always gotta be so mad?
I got a lot to be mad about.
Context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 8th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our compensatory call-in. Dial in, observations, thoughts, lots went down over the past 7 days. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. Zero. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. A few quick things before we get to callers, if y'all have things you would like to share. If there are listeners in the Tampa, Florida area, I guess for listeners, period, in the Florida area, Georgia, South Carolina, or wherever else you happen to be, anyone, I know we might even have folks who are in the Caribbean someplace, definitely thoughts and prayers with folks there. Lots of black people suffered tremendous loss of life as well in Haiti, and just a real disruptive situation, devastating situation on the East Coast, Western Hemisphere right now. Thoughts and prayers to folks there. But if we have any folks who are in the Tampa area, COWS listeners, and you would be interested in having contact with other COWS listeners, trying to be constructive in the Tampa, Florida area, feel free to drop an email. Also for listeners, if you are in the Leeds area, so this is England, Leeds area. I know we have a good number of UK listeners. I am not sure about exact locations. So if you are in the Leeds area, drop an email. We have folks there specifically who would be interested in getting in contact with other folks in the same region. Keep it constructive. Keep it constructive. Other quick notes to get to, I guess, for other people, if you're in wherever you happen to be at, if you could just, if you send an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com, and just put the city, put whatever location you are. So Leeds contact, Tampa contact, you know, Southern California contact, whatever it happens to be. And I will try to forward things along with that. Quickly before we get to folks who called in, I played Solange's song featuring Lil Wayne at the conclusion of the news clips. I think at least some of our listeners have concluded that this is an attempt at counter-racism at some level with what she is talking about on the whole project. And then I think with that song specifically, the song that I played, Mad. Okay, now I don't know if you could catch all of the lyrics if that was your first time hearing it. Even Lil Wayne's part, and I can't really say I'm a big fan of Lil Wayne, but I did think on his second verse where he talks about attempting suicide and people being upset that he didn't die, right? I have to take him literally on that because he does have a song called I Feel Like Dying, very popular from a while back. That, and he lost family members in Hurricane Katrina, and he's talked about that publicly. I played an interview where he talked about that. We were doing our Katrina study session, and I'm sure some of our listeners recall, I think, the situation within the last month or so. He did an interview where he said that he hasn't experienced racism. He can honestly say that he hasn't experienced racism, and some people were upset about that and what have you. And I thought about it within the context both of, at least that's what he said here, if he attempted suicide, the self-destruction, the impact, the black mental health aspect of racism, white supremacy. But I thought about it within the context of this song, Mad. That is what happens when you are not allowed to be angry, not allowed to acknowledge the truth of racism, white supremacy. And I think that's the position that a lot of black people find themselves, ourselves in regularly. But just looking at the lyrics of the Lil Wayne's part, right? The suicide, I think, is most important, although he has some other interesting lines in there as well. So, okay. Then we look at Solange's lyrics. And she says, I ran into this girl. She said, why are you always blaming? Why can't you just face it? Why you always got to be mad? Be mad, be mad, be mad, which I think is real subtle but slick as well. So then it continues, I got a lot to be mad about. I would think that should resonate with a lot of black people. There certainly is lots for us to be angry about and then subtly be mad, be mad, be mad. She gets to the end of the song. She says, I ran into this girl. I said, I'm tired of explaining. Why can't you just face, man, this shit is draining. but I'm not really allowed to be mad. That for sure is black people. You are not allowed to be angry about being terrorized by whites. That everyday experience. I don't know what else she could be talking about if it's not racism, white supremacy, just not stated as explicitly. And I think we've talked about that on the program before. Sometimes the counter racism in the music is not as overt as I'm black and I'm proud or Public Enemy, Fight the Power. They could have picked a lot of Public Enemy's work, but something like Our Day Will Come, looked at in proper context, counter-racist effort. That's what I think is going on here. It might be going on for the whole album. I just haven't heard the whole thing yet, but I do like that song. All righty. We will get to callers. Nate Parker used the word context a lot. I didn't even play the full interview, but I can say from that interview, I think Ava DuVernay, she used it, or she said it, and then it was said within the trailer for her new film as well. Man, either more folks are listening to The Cows than I thought, or I just did a really good job in selecting a name for the program. I guess it could be both, but just those little snippets when the word context drops, that should add further clarity for why this broadcast is the context of white supremacy. If we could not use metaphors for the program today, that would be super appreciated. If we could just try to be explicit, blatant, simple, and direct with what we are trying to say. I've stated consistently, I think racists, they will regularly employ metaphors, analogies, false equivalencies to try to confuse us in relating things that are simply not equal. I think a lot of times just victims of racism in our confusion and just trying to figure out the best way to articulate our views. Sometimes we use metaphors when the things that we are comparing are not accurate, and we might even be promoting some confusion in suggesting that two things are similar when they are not. So if we could avoid the metaphors, analogies, just speak clearly, exactly, specifically about what it is we would like to say. Thank you kindly. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The first few folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free. If you could watch the background noise, that would be great. If you know you're in a loud environment, if you could use your mute button, if you know you're around people or whatever the case, just use your mute button. That way it will not disrupt the quality of the program. Thank you much. So first few folks who dialed in, lines should be open. Feel free to participate. Yes, sir.
Good evening, guys. Good evening to all the callers. Thomas in New York. Interesting week, interesting clips. The Georgia cop, they've been cracking down on people with their social media posting. It's not quite to the point where it's consistent across the board to get fired or whatever, but it's starting to catch up to that. The Georgia cop, what would kill me was the cop that left before he got fired. If he was rehired at another police before, white people don't get fired, they get transferred. I think that it would be appropriate for all black people in that area who got a ticket from them over the past decade, however long they've been doing it, to maybe file a class action lawsuit. Because unless they're going to go back, because what lawfully should be done is any of the tickets or arrests they've made should be reviewed. They've proven to be biased. I would say as far as the clip about Canada, I wish they would just leave Nigger Rock alone. It sounds like what white people would call, if black people came out with a new form of heavy metal music, they'll call it nigger rock, you know? And it's like Texas Governor Rick Perry's got his nigger head inch. I think it's just a reflection of white supremacy. Leave the names as they are.
I wonder if the Canadian soldiers will be sending a little bit of extra more child support down to their Haitian children, being that they had that catastrophe happen there. Worst place for that to happen. Hillary Clinton, she's the most dangerous person for black people, I swear. And I personally, I have her losing every state but D.C. She's on the stage last week talking about how criminalized black men are and how they're being targeted. And Trump said he's going to re-implement stop and frisk. I said, oh, she has no chance. no chance at all. I think that the super predator comments might help her. You know, maybe I'll remind them, the white people how she really is. But, yeah, trying to get the black vote is not going to help her in this election. I don't think so. School terrorism, campus racism is everywhere. Just be on the lookout for it. Every week I could pull out tens of stories. Chris Rock, he felt like Django Unchained was a insult to Nat Turner. And I said, but he called Dellinger a degenerate, so it was a false economy. Chris Rock. Around my neighborhood, we had a Popeye's restaurant where someone got home with their chicken and it was a fried rat head in it. And since then, and it's been about 3 weeks now, I've paid attention and I could count the amount of black people I've seen in Popeye's, which is usually just jam-packed. But it's full of whites and Asians all of a sudden, and I just found that to be very compelling. I never knew this many whites. I never knew this many Asians even lived around here. I just was like, every time I walked past, it's very interesting. This story is sort of like the super predators. And I was listening to another program, and the person mentioned the crack baby myth. And I never really thought about it, but if you Google Dr. Hart, H-A-R-T, crack baby, put that together in Google and a bunch of articles will pop up. Dr. Carl Hart is a black man. He's a neuropsychopharmacologist. So he's accredited because I don't even know if I pronounced that right, but he's from Columbia University. So, I mean, that's Ivy League. He's worked there for quite some time. He studied crack babies for 20 years, and his studies show that there's no physical or mental difference between a crack baby, so-called crack baby, and a regular child. And I just found that to be interesting. And in some of the articles, it goes on to explain how this was, you know, made up by the white people to further criminalize black people, to take their kids away from them and do things like that, all based on something that they knew wasn't true. They knew this wasn't true, and they went along with this thing, just like the super predator. And I mentioned this to my aunt. And, you know, my whole family is full of teachers. My aunt, my mother, my grandmother, all her siblings, all teachers. And she gave me so much pushback. Like, you know, she was angry that, you know, I've seen these kids. They come in, they're already sexual, they're already hyper. And I'm like, you know, maybe that's because they were being raised by fatheads. I mean, you know, or maybe because the second generation of teen mom, or maybe because the first generation of kids, you know, watching their mom and then their grandmama getting dressed to go out to the same club. You know, I mean, there's a lot of other reasons for that. But also, this Dr. Hart, he also did an article which I found to be very interesting and could affect us in the future. If you Google Dr. Hart, H-A-R-T, Adderall is mess. A whole bunch of articles should pop up about his research, and this mess, in my opinion, will be the new crack of the future in our neighborhoods. I hear Adderall being mentioned in all these rap songs now, sort of like they, you know, when I grew up, it was weed, but now they're talking about all these pills, and Adderall is pretty prominent, and it's prescribed to people for focusing, to focus, and it's being prescribed to black kids more than
I mean, they account for almost 70% of their sales. And this is given to them for ADHD. And it's addictive. You know, when I was working at the law firm, when I would do the office moves, these lawyers had drawers full of this in generic forms of it, because I would pull out my phone and look up to see what they take. And, you know, I'm being nosy like white people are. And it would be this Adderall. And if it has the same physical components to you as meth, what's going to happen when these kids turn 18 and they're no longer able to get Adderall from the state government and, you know, whatever. You know, some of these kids, parents are getting paid to give them these ADHD drugs. So we're going to be looking for the next best thing.
Thank you, Thomas in New York. Appreciate that. That about the crack babies, that is in Medical Apartheid, which we just finished reading, and Dorothy Roberts killing the black body when she was on the program in 2009. Any of the other folks who have a hand up have commentary you wanted to share?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry about that. Hi. I wanted to kind of talk about they had the guy, the Caucasian guy that was watching the person that had called the police and how they searched him and just terrorized him, searched his backpack, and how he stood there that long and watched, and then thereafter he said something and then told the boy he had the right to tell them they don't have to search him, but he doesn't have the right to tell them not to search him, because they do what they want to do. They'll kill you. They'll do it just like when they said to him, like, well, hey, you defended him? And then he has the right to say that, but now they're saying, okay, well, yeah, you're bothering them, but don't let them do that to you. Defend yourself, but we don't have the same right. So it just seems like maybe they'll start saying, well, you let them do it where you don't defend yourself. You just sit there. So that's what I thought when I heard the guy say that. And the work, just like in general on all the clips, the words that they use when they describe how wish they're terrorized, they say things to defend it or make it seem, oh, well, you know, they didn't even know. It's just all of a sudden they just always defend themselves. So it's like, oh, we're not racist. It's an accident. Like it's an accident. Well, we didn't know. It just so happened to be racist. Who knew? And then with Nat Turner, how the guy that was doing the movie, how when he was talking to the other guy, they were stating he didn't, when the white people described him, he didn't have a family. He wasn't the way he actually was with the family, like maybe leading that he was gay. And how when he was having other people read the script, other directors, they liked the movie, but they didn't love it because he didn't have enough good white people in it. And how, as directors, they all know, I mean, black directors in general, that they have to have a lot of good white people in anything, even though that with our Foolish movies, we don't have to have a lot of good white people. Well, we do have good white people in our Foolish movies, too. But they can have all white movies all the time and not have any black cast, but we must. And they know it, too, the black directors. It's just interesting. And when the lady spoke about how they overrepresent black males, and how, because they do, to make people think that, oh, well, I'm glad that these things happen to them, or I'm glad that they go to jail, or just not care about what happens to the black males. And then, of course, they're after us because, you know, we're them also. So that's all I wanted to state from the clippings that were played, and I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Mabby Hart?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, this is Lady in New York.
I'm definitely going to be listening to the clips again when you post it. When the Young Turks, I don't remember the host, his name, when he was speaking about the police officer, I guess, was spreading some racist commentary with his colleagues, how he was fired. And when he said, God bless, I don't know if this was the chief, whatever officer was in charge of him, who suspended or fired or, you know, got this guy transferred to a better position, God bless him because he does not do this racist activity openly. I was like, did he know that what he just said? Because I interpreted what he said as, I'm happy that at least he's codified. So I don't know. That was very, that made me put some thought into that, and that's when I'm going to listen to it again in the archives. I don't know if this is happening in other towns or any of the viewers and areas where they live, but we've been having in our local newspaper this continual news story circulating because there is a group called Make Rochester White Again, and they have their website, which is whiterochester.org. They have been going to the whitest of white parts of town. I live in a very, very small town. So they go to the suburbs, and they've been in two, and they've just overnight distributed hundreds and hundreds of flyers, prompting people to go to this whiterochester.org website and, I don't know, talk about making Rochester great again, which equals making Rochester white again. The suburbs they've gone to, one was 76% white, one was 86% white. White people have gotten a rally, the first one they went to, and the white mother decided to make this rally because she has black children, non-white children. And so she was very disheartened because she doesn't want her non-white children to live in that kind of climate. I think there's been more than one of these rallies. I'm not really sure. It's held out in the suburban locations. The writer was discussing that, I think it was a gentleman, that he expects his neighborhood to get hit next because it's the third whitest neighborhood. And he also mentioned about on the flyers that they are asking for volunteers to specifically target and distribute flyers where primarily white people live. So they want to have white people recruit other white people to, I guess, keep the areas that they are living in white or make them even whiter, which, again, one place is like 86%, one place is 76%, one town was like 94% white. I think they hit just two towns. So I'd like to go now that they, for a while, they were not posting the web address, this whiterochester.org. They were just talking about the fact that it said Make Rochester Great Again and that it was racist. Now they're putting in the articles this web address. So I'll be going on there and looking at it. I'd love to get a hold of one of these flyers or a picture of this flyer because I think a lot is being left out of what exactly this flyer is saying. So I'd like to definitely get that. And if anyone's interested, I'll, you know, let you know if I get a hold of the flyer and what it says. And I definitely like to hear if this type of material has been distributed in anyone else's town recently. So
that's it. I guess I'll mute my line for now.
Appreciate that. I just wanted to get in the caller before, lady in New York. Desmond Cole was the broadcaster who was talking about the situation where the young black male was being accosted by enforcement officers in Canada, and he told them that he didn't have to allow them to search him and what have you. Desmond Cole is a black male, just so that people understand, haven't seen him before. He is a black male, so this was a black male observing this other black person being molested by the police, and they spoke up, and then the police came over and tried to snatch his phone and all that. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, line should be open.
Can I? You go first, firefighter in Florida.
Thank you, sir. Greetings, everyone, and to the host and everybody. I would like to have permission to play a 38-second audio. It kind of like sums up the relationship the global system of racism and white supremacy has with Haiti. Do I have permission, Gus?
Oh, yes, sir.
All right. And then I'm going to make a brief comment on it. Hold on for a second.
Picking up maybe 30 to 40 inches of rainfall, we're really concerned about Haiti. So we look at the area of Dominican Republic, and you notice what's different in this NASA image. You see all brown here and then green to the east. That's because this whole area has been essentially deforested. They take all the trees down. They burn the trees. Even the kids there, they're so hungry, they actually eat the trees. Now, what...
I hope you heard the last point. Where she, if the caption is Weather Channel's Jen Delgado, Haiti defrosted, deforested because kids eat the trees. Basically, that was done by a meteorologist, quote unquote, from the Weather Channel. Basically, my comment on it was, Haiti, I think, is a reminder to non-white people from the white supremacists saying, I will permanently mistreat you for attempting to stand up against me. I will keep your country, I will keep your economy, construction, ecology, unstable just because you attempted to wage counter war against me, your white master. Despite this reality, there are answers to the problem of racist white supremacy. Basically, what Ms. Delgado was doing was, in a sophisticated way, showing humiliation towards non-white people who are the most unfiltered in terms of sexual contact in this part of the world with white people, primarily because they actively have stood up physically to defend themselves against white people. This has been going on for a long period of time. The situation is so bad in Haiti that the white supremacists don't have to physically be around to mistreat them. Their ecology is so unstable. All it takes is a strong wind and they're gonna have disaster every single time. And then after that, as we all have witnessed back with the earthquake, then the white people come in with their money schemes and also stealing babies, that sort of thing. So it's a constant that goes on with Haiti. And for the most part, any reports on them is going to be some level of ridicule and humiliation in that light, which is a common practice with white people who practice racism. And you can see this, I guess you can get this from via the Weather Channel if you wanted to see it in full. It's 38 seconds long. I just ran 24 seconds of it, and I think that was enough that you heard on what Ms. Delgado put in her report. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Roz, were you going to share, sir?
Yes, I was just having trouble with my mute button. Thank you. Yeah, I did actually see that clip. It kind of made headlines on the internet because it just reminds me of their description of Haiti kind of reminds me of their descriptions of Africa as, you know, place where people wear grass skirts and run around naked and chuck spears all the time. That kind of commentary kind of takes me back to that because, like you said, Haiti, they're just an ongoing shining example of the kind of brutality white people are capable of, especially when you seek to liberate yourself or help others liberate themselves in any way, shape, or form against white supremacists. The clip about Nigger Rock in, I think it was Quebec, Canada, I was really glad that the black male did not want to change the name from Nigger Rock to something else. I like the way he articulated the fact that he understood that that term was a derogatory term, but in order to commemorate the violence against our African ancestors in that specific area, he felt the name should not be changed, which I agree with emphatically. One thing I find that white people tend to do, just historically speaking, is they change names of places all the time. And these are the ways that they choose to take your term, Gus, obfuscate reality or to doctor the way people view what actually happened in a particular place. First, they tend to change the indigenous names first to disconnect the indigenous people from their ancestry in that land to something that they arbitrarily choose to name it, usually after one of their racist ancestors. And then after that, if there are tragedies that happen there, they'll change the name in order to remove or try to cleanse the memory of the tragedy that took place in that particular area. So I'm glad he spoke out about that. I thought that the clips that were played during Democracy Now, the discussion with Ava DuVernay, I thought that they were really good. I think the documentary is going to be awesome. I didn't see it yet. I'm hoping to get to see it because it really sounds like it provides quite a bit of great information about the candidates that are being paraded in front of us in regards to a lot of their activities prior to reaching this point in American history. So I think it'll give people a lot to think about. Hopefully we can make a collectively positive decision in regards to doing something about them getting into office, but I doubt that'll be the case in the system of white supremacy. I wanted to say happy birthday to Fannie Lou Hamer. Her birthday was this past week. So I just wanted to give a shout out to that prominent black female ancestor for the work that she's done for our people. Nate Parker, in the clip you played on the Nat Turner film, he had said that the film was connected to the worst period in American history, and that, in my opinion, that period of history never stopped. It's just transformed in appearance and has been refined to a point that we can't even understand anymore just how bad it really is in some cases, some of us anyway. And so I think that whole statement gives the idea that somehow we're in a better place now than we were back then, when, in my opinion, the only thing they did was take the physical shackles off, but everything is exactly the same as it was any time in American history at this point, in my opinion. Also, when you did play the song with Solange and Lil Wayne, I actually thought it was a Lil Wayne song, so I'm glad you clarified that. And I do think I did get to hear the lyrics, but I never heard the song before, and I could agree with you on that I think it is a counter-racist effort by Lil Wayne. And also, I thought about what you spoke about in regards to him saying that he's never dealt with racism before. And recently, he took a very, very brief retirement in regards to an ongoing financial theft situation between himself and Baby, who is one of the two owners of his record label. And I do remember when he came out with that statement about saying he never dealt with racism. I think ASAP Rocky, if I'm not mistaken, was another rapper who came out and said the same thing. And I thought about him specifically because he says that he's never dealt with racism, but the situation with Baby kind of spilled over due to the fact that he's had a horrible contract. He's been with him since he was about 10 years old. And he's been fighting to get the money that is due him. I guess he feels is due him for the work that he's put in for the record label. And I was thinking about it, and I'm like, well, where did Baby get the idea to give him such a horrific contract in the first place? That's white people. It's white supremacy. You know, it's not like these things happen in a vacuum. He's following the historical model that has been set by white supremacists from the time that the music industry was created. And they've always capitalized most off of black music and culture, yet they also abuse and exploit those same black artists just as horrifically as our ancestors were on the plantation. So I just wanted to kind of chime in with those things. I thank you for taking my call, and I mute my line.
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I have a few questions. Excuse me for taking so long chewing and stuff like that. One question I would like to ask is it uncodified, like, for non-white, you know, victims of racism who are black descendants of slaves, is it uncodified for them to seek reparations in the form of nationhood, sort of like Israel got? Because, and the reason I ask that question, because, you know, according to the code, there is no country other than white supremacy. And in my opinion, what I see going on a lot, like when I'm listening to Hillary Clinton talk about how black grandmothers have to go through so much that she does not have to go through. And when I see people protesting flags and, you know, things of that nature that represents white supremacy, it's like, and I could be wrong, but this is just my opinion as a victim of racism, it seems like what white and non-white people are doing is just like playing a game, going in circles, stating the obvious. You know, where we know what's going to be the problem. We know, just from me, myself, and speaking as a victim of racism in Alabama, I know that if we continue to live in the United States, or not even live in the United States, but be in the United States as, I know this is uncodified, but just for lack of a better term, I do not have any other word to use, for us to keep seeking integration, it's like we're going to keep going in circles, going in circles, going in circles. And I think people are just playing games with us, you know. And I don't think the integration, is, for lack of a better term, is playing games. I think that they're just going after what they see as freedom, you know, to be accepted in the quote-unquote United States, for lack of a better term. But what's going on from my lens is people like stating the obvious, going in circles, but no one is asking for reparations in the form of nationhood. It's like that conversation has even became outdated, you know. And, you know, like you have your Dr. Umar's, you have your, Tariq Nasheed's and other people who do speak about certain things like that, but it's like the conversation is being drowned out about people that just want to speak about the problem, but not talk about repairing the problem or reparations, you know. And I just would like to know, is that uncodified to even seek reparations as a victim of racism in the form of nationhood?
In my view, and I mean, I observe United Independent counter-racism, so everybody does not have the exact same code in terms of what they think the best thing to do or say in responding mm-hmm. to racism, white supremacy. In my view, I don't see anything uncodified or incorrect about making a request for reparations in the form of quote-unquote nationhood. I don't see anything incorrect or uncodified about it. I would say, to me, I don't think that would solve the problem. I'm not sure if you said that would solve the problem, but just in my view, it would not solve the problem. I think that people, and for me, I think a lot of it comes down to just not grasping or articulating racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works accurately, that you do not solve that problem with quote-unquote integration. You do not solve that problem with, in my view, quote-unquote, having our own nation. All of that would require white people to stop practicing racism and practice justice. They're not going to do that. So, in my view, if we had our own spot, if you're talking about a piece of land, a geographic location, and this is our quote-unquote nation, these are the boundaries for it, and we'll just pile all the black folks here and right on, get to it, build your own thing. That would require whites are not going to practice racism against the black people in this area now that we are wherever we are, if that's someplace here in North America or wherever on the globe. They're still going to practice. I mean, there's tons of examples. Haiti, it's tons of examples of areas where they have black people and they say they have their own independent nation and they are still subject to the system of white supremacy. That's just the position that I've taken. So I wouldn't say there's anything incorrect about asking for it. You can certainly do that. There are people Monday, people that are putting out calls for reparations. You're saying specifically in the form of a nation, right? So I wouldn't say anything incorrect or uncodified about doing it. I just I don't think that would solve the problem.
And see, the reason I noticed that, because if you look at what's going on in the United States, and I'll be done after I say this, if you look at what's going on in the United States, just speaking for where we at right now, when you see people that are being killed or targeted by government-sanctioned officials for murder, you know, you would notice, it's like you can't help but notice, they'll rally people who come over here from Ethiopia who are being targeted by government-sanctioned officials. It happens. I'm not saying it just never happens, but it doesn't happen so much that we just have Ethiopia fussing at the United States for killing Ethiopian citizens. If you notice the same thing with Kenyans, same thing with Saudi Arabia, you would rarely even see an Arab get killed by police while unarmed. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it doesn't happen. Nowhere near it happens to the descendants of slaves. And I think, in my humble opinion, I think that it's because that those people have countries that they can go run to. They can go run to embassies. They can go run to different countries. And these countries can say, hey, we're not selling you no more coffee beans. We're not selling you no more gold. We're not selling you, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to have sanctions against the United States, but we're going to, you know, try to back up from the United States because why? They're killing our citizens too much. But when black people who are descendants of slaves are targeted by government-sanctioned officials outright for murder, and sometimes they're not even government-sanctioned officials. Sometimes they're just regular white citizens like Dylan Roof. But we have no embassy we can run to, you know, and in my humble opinion, I don't, like you said, I did not say that that would end the system of white supremacy, but it would stop us from being splattered all over the news each and every day that we're getting shot down, And to end my statement, it's not like I'm saying that all black people have to agree with, you know, reparations in the form of nationhood. Because the way I look at it, like, for the people who choose to integrate, they have that same right to integrate as we have to seek nationhood. Now, once we seek nationhood, and the people who decide to stay, if they, two generations later, are continued to be splattered all over the screen for being killed by government-sanctioned officials and private white citizens, and they're two, three generations later, marching around, hands up, don't shoot, they have that prerogative to continue that cycle over and over and over and over and over again ad infinitum. But for those of us who would like to, how I say, put a Band-Aid on the wound and just, you know, at least have a nation of our own where we could go seek help. Even the integrations who choose to stay could even probably seek help from this nation of African-American slaves,
you know, where we could have some where we could say, hey, we're not selling you no more of our product that we make in our own nation because the way you're treating our people over there. You know, no country has ever stepped up and said that they will have sanctions on the United States for the treatment of African Americans. And I, like I said, I'm a review victim, and I'm going to mute my line and continue to learn. And thank you guys for letting me speak my opinion.
Wow. Other folks that we haven't heard from, that y'all have commentary?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, good sense to the rest of the callers. So I was coming home from school one day, and I overheard this white person talking about the clowns. The clowns are scaring people, and if you don't know, the clowns, this month there's been a lot of creepy clowns that have been assaulting, almost killing, and scaring people, threatening schools, standing on highways, roads, and stuff, just doing some crazy stuff. It's just, from my knowledge, it's mainly white people, because you unmask them, you'll find that it's white people in makeup or masks with costumes or whatever. They're just scaring people. We don't know if it's a joke or if it's serious. I think it's serious, but I heard him saying, talking about that, and he's just talking about how it brings them back to the 60s or whatever, when clowns were actually scary and people didn't like clowns. It was pretty interesting when they talked about it. Also, I just wanted to let everybody know that Birth of a Nation is coming out on Tuesday, and the group Black Student Union, including me, we're going to see that on Tuesday. And yeah, I'll let everybody know how it goes and what it is. But I find this movie trailer interesting because it just brings me back to when the first slavery movie was, to the first slavery movie I've ever saw, and I think it was Butler. And yeah, I'm not sure how it's going to go this time, but I'll let you guys know. But that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
We will be looking forward to, once you see the film, to get your observations and afterthoughts once you've seen it. And if you write anything about it, we can publish it on the blog. That would be great. I'm sure other folks would like hearing what you think about Mr. Parker's project. Right on. Other folks have commentary they want to share? Should be with us if we haven't heard from you yet.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, Gus. Hello, caller. This is Ms. Meds, a dental assistant out in Portland, Oregon. I wanted to answer, I think it was Lady's question in New York about flyers. Well, we get those out here a lot. So, I mean, there's at least a couple of them that happen a year. Especially when the weather is good, like in the springtime. I guess for whatever, they don't like to put them out on people's cars when it's raining, and you know they could bleed and people can't read them. But they often pop up in Beaverton, Hillsdale, Tualatin. I haven't heard any in Portland. They're always like these kind of really white suburbs that are not Portland, so it's always something that happens on the other side of the Willamette. Not really new. I mean, it happens at least a couple times. I would say at least 2 to 3 times a year that I can keep track of. Moving on to something different. This week, actually, Gus, I was trying to email you about something very frantically that I found out about last minute. I'm an avid gamer, and there's this game called Mafia 3, which just came out yesterday. I didn't really think it was a big deal. There's been a rash of games coming out with these black characters or black protagonists, and, you know, I didn't really think put too much thought into it. Yeah, so what? You know, they're painting people black now. But I woke up and I saw the reviews, and it was just on fire for this game. And so I started looking into it, and come to find out, the reason why it is blowing up is because it's about racism. This character, this is a Mafia 3 game again. This is the third installment of it. The other two were pretty much about white Italian mobsters. So there was outrage. They put this black character in there. And the premise of the story is that he is a Vietnam vet or some sort of person with military background. He is on a racist rampage against white people. And in the game, there's like people dressed in Klan outfits, and they actually, you can take people to this river and throw them in and get them eaten by alligators. This is based in Louisiana. So my mind was racing very frantically to contact you about this, because I did go back in the archives, and you had a past one about video games and racism. And I've got many stories to tell about that, but I can save that for another time. But I think that one was about Resident Evil 5. But this just came out yesterday. And I was going to email you about it because I did pick it up. I do plan on playing it. But I also did some research into it. And the dev team is, of course, all white people that I could see. And the pattern that I've been noticing when they're slapping these black characters on these games is that they're claiming diversity in the game, but then yet you're not practicing that in your business. There's no black developers, there's no black writers, there's no black artists, none of that. So I found that to be interesting. And when I was doing looking for a review, I also emailed you a video of these two white guys who were trying so hard to explain racism. One of them was like an English guy, and the other one was just like your typical bearded white cis male hipster, who knows, could be a Portlander. Anyway, and they were just, you know, racism is just so hard, and this is just a heavy topic, and, you know, these type of issues, we should just bury them. And they also said at the end of the video that white people would think that the game is telling them that they are a racist. Not their behavior. The game is going to tell them that they're a racist. So I emailed you that video. Do what you want with it. Maybe use it for next week's story. I'm sure there'll be lots of videos and commentary coming from white people, because that's pretty much all there is in the gaming community. There's not very much representation with anybody else other than white males. But I was trying to contact you to find out if it would be okay if I let people know where they could watch this if they wanted to. Gus?
Whatever you had in mind, if you want to let people know how they can watch it.
Okay, cool. I have a Twitch account on Twitch. It's called twitch.tv/medicinalgamer. That's twitch.tv/medicinalgamer. And I'll pretty much start Mafia 3 momentarily after the compensatory. So people don't have to pay for it. I'm an enthusiast, and when I heard about it, I had to hop out of bed and go grab it. So that's what I was emailing you about, Gus.
right on. I got the email, and I'm on your site. I'll put it on our Facebook page so people can check it out there if they are so interested. I think Thomas in New York had emailed about this game. There seemed to be some buildup, like people knew that racism was going to be a component of the game, so they were already kind of talking about it in a controversial way, I think, within the last month, maybe right at kind of the end of summer, I think some of the reports started coming
out about it. Yeah, it was actually from August, that little clip that I sent you. It was funny, I went and snagged a couple reviews. Maybe I can read a couple later in the program.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, sweet. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you had commentary you wanted to share, feel free. Your line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Jay, Jay out of New York. Greetings to you, Gus, the Cows callers and listeners. I'm a first-time caller. I've been listening to the archives here for the last, I would say, 3 to 4 weeks, and thanks for the constructive platform. It's been kind of lonely before getting connected here. Just wanted to reach out in reference to the context of the show, and I missed the earlier part, the first hour, but wanted to let the family know that my 96-year-old grandmother in Haiti, we actually found her just yesterday, and my aunt and some other family members. So with all the stuff that is going on, we were able to kind of come out and get some positive news with the activities going on in the world today. So just wanted to share that with the family. And then also kind of reach out to everybody and say all the best to those suffering in the different areas, in the Bahamas and Jamaica, Haiti, and even some of the coastal areas here in the U.S. So shout to everybody on that. And what else did I have here? Oh, I did want to touch on the Facebook portion of things and all the, I'm not sure if they call it the screenshots or the Pray for Paris, Pray for Orlando, and definitely the differentiation between when it happens to non-white people, how there is no consideration. I expect it from Facebook, but the thing that I find a bit disturbing is the non-white victims that are out there posting the post for Pray for Paris, Pray for Orlando. And when something happens of tragic nature to the non-white black individual across the globe, it's amazing how quiet it is, you know, in different areas or pray for anything. But it's just amazing to me as I see that, just the contrast, even from the non-white black individuals kind of out there not even able to just even share the news from that perspective. And the, I don't know if it's fear, I don't know if it's just a disconnect with one another, but that's one thing that I found to be pretty disturbing, how quickly people are ready to just post Pray for Paris, Pray for Orlando, but when it comes to something that's kind of hitting close to home, like family members or even neighbors, next door neighbors that they know, they won't even kind of come out and just make a mention of it. But I guess it just kind of falls right in line with the victimization that we've gone through for many years. And I think that's kind of all I had. I had some other things about some of the loving story that you talked about in the archives. I saw some things on Facebook, but I'll mute my line and kind of speak to that later on after some other folks touch base on it.
Appreciate that, and absolutely, that is phenomenal about your grandmother. I'm super glad to hear that, and just echo again your thoughts and prayers with folks who are in the impacted region, but extremely glad to hear the good news about your grandmother. Other folks that we have not heard from, if you're on the line, we haven't heard from you, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to tell you about an observation I had this week, and it's pretty much with the elections, how
they pander towards the black vote and how, like, the black vote is sacred. And, like, it, during the debates, it's, like, half about the black votes. And, I mean, they don't talk anything about anything. It's pretty much all about the black vote. And, like, if you, like, the same people that pander towards the black vote, they hate Black Lives Matter. It's like all lives matter, but they don't say all votes matter. You know what I mean? It's like, and that's the only time that they actually act like we got any power after we vote for whoever we vote for. They knock us over the head for 4 years. But the, for that moment during this election, if you look, they don't, the Italians don't complain. Like, they're pandering towards blacks only, like they do with Black Lives Matter or anything else. I mean, no branch or any or group of any white people says, you know, they're pandering towards black people, black vote. But when it comes to Black Lives Matter, anything, you know, constructive for poor black people, it's like, oh, no, all lives matter. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, just one of those things that I noticed this week. And I'll mute my line.
Interesting. We had some of that in the audio clip to begin things today. Other folks that we have not heard from, did you have commentary?
Hello, can I be heard?
Go ahead, Puff. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, the only thing I want to say is the man that just spoke that he found his grand. I hope your grand do well. That's all I want to say.
Ashe, well said. The other folks that we have not, anybody else that we have not heard from at all, that you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everybody. I'll be short, but I wanted to, like, I'm a non-white female. I'm a black woman. And I know there's, like, a lot of controversy regarding what Nate Parker allegedly did. But just based off of my observations and the semi-excitement I heard at the beginning when people, when his movie first became known that it was going to come out, and pretty much how black people are responding to the movie now. And no one is saying it's because of the alleged rape allegation, but people just, black people seem really apathetic about it. When I'm like asking people about it, some people don't even know what it is, don't even know what the story of it is. And I think that the racist white supremacists have been really effective in dissipating the energy. Because it, I don't, to be honest, I don't know what he did. I don't, like, I don't think it has anything to do with the fact that Matt Turner's rebellion has been put in a movie. I don't care if it's 100% accurate, historically accurate. There's so many historical movies that are not historically accurate, and no one seems to have a problem. For instance, one of the things I thought about was 300. That's based off of, like, loosely based off of something that happened in history, but I'm pretty sure no one had a problem that that main Spartan supposedly went to war because of some love he had for his wife or his son. But people seem to have a problem that Nat Turner's rebellion, like, he decided to do that because his wife was in the movie gang raped, and they're like, well, that's not historically accurate. And I think, who cares? I also think that that's a kind of a powerful, I don't want to call it a motif, but a powerful thing to say, like, well, Nat Turner might have started this rebellion because his wife was gang raped by these white men, and he was strong. He was like, F this and everything like that. Like, I think that that's good. And so I'm not getting into any of that. I don't know. Like, I'm not, just to be honest, I haven't codified my money spending all like that. So I can't sit here and say, well, I'll never pay for a movie. And since I'll never pay for a movie, I won't see that. But I think that that's kind of powerful. I think Birth of a Nation is powerful in its own right. And I'm excited to see it. I do want to see it. And I'm really sad because I've even spoken to some black people who were like, well, I don't want to see it because it would make me mad. And I'm thinking that might be why he made the movie, you know, or that might be a good thing, you know. And instead, black people around, the people that I've spoken with, it could just be my circle. I could be mistaken. But just being quite apathetic about it. And I think that that's just crazy when there's so many slave movies that everyone is running to, you know. People will sit and say that 12 Years a Slave was something great. And I think that that's horrible. I even thought the acting was horrible. I thought the production was horrible, you know. Just, it wasn't even original. To me, it wasn't. But
anyway, I just wanted to say that because someone else had mentioned Birth of the Nation. I haven't seen it, but I think the racist white supremacists were kind of effective in dissipating the energy or the excitement that Black people could have had for a movie like that. There was a clip that you played earlier, Gus, about, I think in Canada, where they call it like nigger rock or something like that. And some people want to change it. And the man that was speaking said that he didn't. I don't know if anyone else has talked about it on the show right now, but I kind of agree with him. I think that it might be good to leave things like certain places, names like this. Like I know in Florida, there's a place called like Coonsville or something like that. And I think like if we change the names now, I think that benefits racist white supremacists more than it benefits non-white Black people. I think because it pretty much is like, well, this is something good that, you know, this is what a racist white supremacist would say. Well, you know, we've changed the names, things have changed, when in fact nothing has changed. It just the name was changed. And I kind of like, not to say that I liked it, but I agreed with what he said was logical. Like if we leave it, then it links us back to history. Like it reminds us of pretty much what was, but kind of what still is. And I really do think the changing of the names benefits the racist white supremacists a little bit more than it would benefit us. There wasn't any like particular news clip on this, but it's something that I've been kind of paying attention to because I think I might have listened to the compensatory call from last week on the 1st of October, and someone might have mentioned like the importance of being serious. And I do like I'm paying a lot more attention to that, and it's kind of urgent, honestly, because whenever we do talk about racism, it's always from a joking perspective. And I do get that because we've been so traumatized and we deal with so much and it's so hurtful and I think kind of scary at the same time that you've had we smile to keep from crying. But we do get to be quite serious about, you know, what's going on with us and what time we're living in. But one thing that I heard, I was in an Aldi and I was in line and I'm in D.C., so I was all black Audi pretty much, which was awesome. And some people were talking, you know, they're being frank, no white people are around. And the things that they were saying, they were like, well, you know, they had, I thought, like a deeper understanding of the riots than I've heard some other people mention. Pretty much that, you know, racist white supremacists want us to riot. So then when we riot, they can practice their skills and use that to enact like a martial law and then control us and then inevitably, you know, lock more of us up or something like that. And that kind of, like, not that that made me happy because that kind of thing shouldn't make me happy, but I was grateful or something like that to hear more conversation that was not like so eager to say, yeah, let's just go out and riot. Let's just do this. Let's just do, there was a little bit more, it was more like chess than like checkers. I felt like that conversation was like, okay, well, we're thinking a little bit more, you know, strategically and not just being so impulsive. And those are just a few of that's my commentary for the evening. Thank you for taking my call. I'll go ahead and mute myself.
Grant, appreciated that. Are there any other folks that we have not heard from? Any other folks that we have not heard from at all? Did you all have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Excuse me. So I actually saw the Birth of a Nation, and I just wanted to say that the movie was phenomenal. After I saw it, I've been looking up reviews, and I've been noticing that a lot of the reviews they're saying that that it's not historically accurate. And also, like what the lady said, she said that they're angry that I guess a black woman being raped started it. But also something that I've been seeing in some of the reviews is that I'm assuming white people are actually, I guess, disturbed or not disturbed, but I guess kind of nervous because he pointed out that basically, he used the scriptures scriptures in the Bible to justify the rebellion. And not only that, and on the same token, I noticed that no one who was pointed out how the slave masters used the Bible to basically did the same thing, used the Bible to justify slavery. I noticed that. Also, another point I want to hit quickly, the point about the video games. White people get so angry about video games. I remember when you change the characters, even if it's in a setting that is normally mostly black. Like, I remember when Grand Theft Auto San Andreas came out, and people, this was like, 13 years ago? And the people were so angry that that somehow a black guy was the protagonist in a game that's set in Compton, like South Central LA. I thought that was phenomenal, and I think that's all I had.
Right on. Let's see. Any other folks who we have not heard from at all? Anybody else who had commentary they wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. Okay, just a second here. Okay, this is Ken Steele from Chicago. And I just wanted to start off by tagging on the last comment that was made regarding video games. I remember when San Andreas, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas, was in high school at the time. And the reaction by my classmates, I went to a mostly white high school in a rural part of northern Michigan. And my classmates, to be expected, were very against the decision to set this in Compton, to have a black lead. And then when it came out, I noted it was very funny that some of them made the comment that the previous Grand Theft Autos were acceptable because they knew that this was some sort of fantasy. However, they said in this installment, San Andreas, that it was too frightening because it seemed so real. Like they apparently would walk around and bump into other black people and get into fights with all the non-playable characters and everything. And they thought that this was an exact replication of reality. And I thought that was very startling and revealing. Even my math teacher at the time, he was giving daily updates about his goings on in the game and how disturbed he was by the game. And this was going on for about a month solid. So I definitely remember that anytime they put black lead characters in video games, yes, these white people will take serious note of that. And it definitely does alter their behavior tremendously. Now, I also wanted to mention a caller earlier, I believe it was Thomas from New York. He mentioned the use of amphetamines by white people and that being the new crack epidemic.
Your volume dropped and went really low, sir. Your volume is really low. Ken, we can barely hear you. I will see if we can get his volume situation corrected because I was having difficulty hearing him. Hopefully, I'll message him and see if he can dial back in and kind of pick up where he left off at. Is anybody else that we have missed? Anyone else that we have missed completely has not been able to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, this is the caller from New Orleans. I was just calling because I wanted to touch on the Nate Parker, ongoing drama that continues to be brought up. I get a little bit discouraged now when I hear most black people, trying to I guess, make excuses for white people to continue to attack him over this. I'm not going to see the movie because I'm just tired of these types of movies coming out. I understand that this particular movie is taking a different angle at shedding light to this particular part of our history when it comes to black people in rebellion. But I'm just kind of just tired of seeing these movies, and either the person is married to Becky, or it's being financed from some group of white people that a lot of us may not know about. And I'm just tired of us just getting the okey-doke, and I just feel like it's, I don't know, we just don't really see the bigger picture, like we don't see the forest before the trees, so I just refuse to try and support any of these types of movies. But but I'm also disturbed, too, like how some, at least some of females, black females that I encounter, whether I discuss with online or in like other chat rooms and stuff, how they've just gravitated to this narrative of feminism and some of the stuff that they say in regards to him. I mean, we still haven't seen any information as regards to the transcript from the trial, any substantial amount of documents and stuff. And it's like the clip that you played with him on the Breakfast Club was quite honestly the first time of me even hearing him speak, because that's how much I've just been trying to avoid even hearing about it, because I'm just tired of the feminist BS along with it from black females. But I just, the more I listen to him now, it's just apparent that somebody like that, being a black male in this type of climate, for him to be found or acquitted for this crime or charge or however you want to put it, and the fact that he was just adamant about it, and then what's the name from Good Morning America? I think that kind of just did it for me, because I'm just tired of them trying to find one of us to try and be the attack dog for white supremacy. And it's just frustrating to watch, but I guess it's to be expected.
For sure. I think, Ken, are you back with us? Did you get your audio issues today?
Yes.
Grand.
Yes, I am.
You dropped out, White, when you were going to Thomas's point about Adderall and that being like the...
Oh, yeah. Okay, so like I mentioned earlier in my call, I was, raised in a mostly white school district. And throughout my education, teachers tried to classify me as ADHD and give me these amphetamine pills that have become really popular. And thankfully, my parents resisted. They never allowed that classification to stick or me to try those pills. And I held on to that perspective of taking those pills throughout college even. That's when it seemed to really explode. I started noticing that a number of my peers were using and abusing Adderall in the different forms that it could be taken. And eventually some of them took to crushing it up and snorting it. I don't know if that made it more effective or whatever, but that's what became fashionable while I was at Michigan State University. Now, after I graduated, I got into corporate America and found myself in a pretty demanding position. And my mentors pushed me into trying and eventually using amphetamines. And they pushed me to a doctor that was specifically there for, it appeared to be, young corporate people, because anytime I was in the waiting room, there were other young 20 to mid 30 somethings waiting in line to get scripts for what I assume was amphetamines. And I was prescribed an amphetamine called Vyvanse. And I took this for a year, and I have to say that turned me into what I would describe, it just altered my personality in ways that I don't think were constructive. And on top of that, I may have had dependency issues, but I was just so kind of repulsed by the side effects after a year that I had no problem quitting cold turkey. I didn't even have to do the whole dramatic flushing them down the toilet or anything like that, or throwing them away. I just have no desire to even feel the effects. I think part of the reason was that the formula that they gave me, Vyvanse, synthesized in your jejunum. So I would get really bad stomach aches whenever I would have to take this stuff. So eventually I just decided to quit. But I've seen people kind of go off the deep end and they are still using amphetamines, and it becomes kind of a daily habit for users. And I can definitely see this becoming a serious health problem down the line as more and more people become addicted to this stuff and are unable to have the resources to get scripts for it. And that's just something that I will report about that. But also, I wanted to report on also with respect to drugs. There was a report of the newscaster that quit her job by announcing it on the air. I don't know if you guys remember this, but 2 years ago, a non-white female in Alaska was a newscaster, and she quit her job, said, I believe, F this job, and she started a dispensary. I think she announced her plans to start the dispensary on the air. And she's the article that I found was on USA Today, and in the article, she's pictured with the co-founder, person by the name of Peter LaMonaco, who I appears to be a white person, and she is appearing to be smoking marijuana with this person. And it seems to be that she is now facing 54 years in prison because of her involvement in the operation of this cannabis club. And mind you, this is, I believe, 6 months before the recreational use of marijuana was legalized in the state of Alaska. So she's making an argument that she did not break any of the rules. But I wanted to note to listeners that regardless of what the states are saying, federal law still prohibits the possession and the distribution and the manufacturing of marijuana. So regardless of how many white people you see making untold millions of dollars on TV, I don't think it is a good idea to get involved with the marijuana trade at this point. And on top of that, if you are going to be involved with marijuana, please don't announce your plans to do so on television. It just seems to me a move that just angers white supremacists. They will take these announcements as a challenge, and then they will go ahead and proceed to meet your challenge with extreme forces. We're seeing in this case, she reports that she interprets her treatment as a modern-day lynching, and that she feels that she has been abandoned by those in the legalization community as her charges become more serious. So I just wanted to report on that. And then also...
if we could hang on 1 second just to make sure we get everybody in. We have one more person that hasn't shared at all, and then we'll see if we have some extra time. Anyone that we have not heard from at all have commentary?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I think it was a part of the audio segment where I mentioned code words, and I think the term Skittles and I think Google and Yahoo was being used. Like that, that's very interesting because I haven't really heard those terms, I guess, being used in a racial way. And I would like to definitely look up some more of that. Is there any kind of way to, I guess, see who maybe came up with using those words? Was it any white people? Do you know that, Gus?
I have never heard the term Google used like as a substitute for nigger or as some sort of coded way of talking about black people. I'm unfamiliar with that, and I don't remember them having like a link for like, you know, this is when, like an etymology of this. Like this is the first recorded instance we have of someone using the term Google, or this is, you know, just to give more detail about when all these came together and if it's a specific person that they know was the one that kind of came up with some of these codes. I didn't see all that additional information, but that would be, you know, something noteworthy to check out.
Could I say something? Encyclopedia Dramatica. If you Google Encyclopedia Dramatica, you can see a number of racist memes and racist codes being discussed, documented, and reported by suspected white supremacists in real time. So that's something that that's a resource that could be of some constructive value.
Oh, okay, because it's very interesting for victims to catch up on the new use of language and how they can distort it for their evil purposes. And there was I think somewhere in Wisconsin, it was a Wisconsin college. They have this hoodie where it says all white people are racist, and it's like a black male holding up a W. And when I read the article, it was also saying stuff like, I guess they were releasing this brand line of hoodies, and one said you can't be revolutionary and homophobic, and you can't end the system without, you know, fighting patriarchy. So I don't know. It may be a white person behind this, but that was the title of the article about hoodies saying that all white people are racist. And it was another article about, I guess, Portland State. It was three white people, I think, on a flyer, but on a report, it had their faces blurred out, and they were going around speaking to a bunch of people on the campus, and, you know, they were saying, you know, I guess they knew these students, and they were saying, well, some of these things that they were saying were just very racist, and these caricatures that they used, I guess, mocking black people, of course. But it, like, they didn't want to reveal their name, you know. They just kept showing the flyer saying, we don't allow racists here. But, like, nobody knows who put the flyers up. But, you know, the reporters, the people they interviewed, you know, all of them, they really weren't trying to condemn their racist practices. But they knew about them, so they definitely didn't showcase any ignorance. And there was a last one where I think it was down in Louisiana, Monroe, Louisiana, is this black mayor. I think his last name is Mayo. Like, it's like this picture on the article I read where it's like a spray painted, like, drawing of the mayor and what appears to be President Obama. And, like, they're turned around, like, it's on the back of this white guy's shirt. And it says, I forgot what it said at the top, but, you know, they had, it was like a cartoon of the two of them. And, like, their pants were sagging. So, you know, I guess some suspected race soldier painted this shirt, and it was a guy wearing it. Like, they didn't show who the guy was. But, you know, it's like, it's amazing how even this is a mayor of a town, and people, you know, still look at him with contempt, so, which is not surprising. And that's all that I have right now. Thank you.
Fascinating. Still just going to be another nigger. I'm sure they've made some brand new racist slurs for him as well. Anybody else that we missed? Anybody who's not been able to share at all? We got everybody. No misses.
Yes, Tom, you're.
Yes, sir.
Greetings to guys, all the listeners and callers. So, yeah, I was supposed to share my vacation back in August. Me, my sister, my two sisters, and my fiance, we went to Vegas. And on the first day, we were walking outside. We were one hotel away from the hotel Bally's. And there was a non-white black female outside. And she was like, how would you guys like to make $25 or $20 or something like that? So we're like, all right, what's the gimmick? She was like, all you guys have to do is watch TV. She was like, it takes about 25 minutes, 30 minutes. And she was like, you guys get paid at the end. So we're like, what's the gimmick? She was like, it's nothing. That's all you do. So we go, and they show, it's like a screening for new shows that's going to come out. And you get to vote if you think that it should go on TV or not. And we saw an episode of a new CSI. It's called You Vote. So I guess, like, the viewers at home, you get to vote on what you feel you saw in the episode or whatever. And this particular one, it was about some white guy having a Confederate flag up. And he's protesting about guns and stuff like that. And he has a sign outside his store that says "No Muslims" or something like that. And it's an Islamic guy who wants to get gun training, but he denies him. So the guy, the Islamic guy, is taking him to court. He's trying to sue him. And like, basically, that he's saying, he has the right. By freedom of speech to put up the sign and say extreme terrorists or something like something to that effect. But we went about two or three times. Every time we went, it was something totally different. We went 3 days in a row. Every day we went, it was something totally different. But every last one of them was basically about racism. They had another one called Superstore or Super Shop, where, yeah, the non-white, non-black Asian, a female who's 16 years old, pregnant, and she works in a supermarket. She's very ignorant, like, extremely slow. She don't know how to do her job. Then they have another non-white, non-black person in a wheelchair. Then they have this black guy who's like the jokester of the store. It was just crazy. But we basically gave it bad reviews and was honest about everything, because you have to go through, like, they'll ask questions at the end, like, do you think this guy was racist? What do you think about this character? How would you rate this? Do you think that it should go on TV? basically you rate it and you get paid at the end. So that was something I forgot to share with you guys. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I'm mute.
Fascinating. I think we might have nabbed all of the callers, thank goodness, because we were getting close to the end. One thing I did want to make sure I got in, I thought it was really important, the section with Nate Parker from The Breakfast Club, when he was talking about how people tried to discourage him from doing a project on Nat Turner. They said, well, why don't you do a film on John Brown? That, I mean, hugely important for many reasons. If you recall, when the second time Dick Gregory was a guest on our program, a part of him becoming upset and leaving was around John Brown and comparing those two historic figures. But one of our investors commented that W.E.B. Du Bois, in his academic career, he wanted to write about Nat Turner. Whites did the same thing. They came in and were like, oh my God, no way. Why don't you do John Brown? Yes, everyone loves John Brown. And that ended up being the person that he wrote about. And I mean, just that sort of continued effort where they know. And just that's the sort of thing that I think you should think about every time you hear someone, white or black, anyone else who says that, you know, black people are cowards, black people are chumps, we've never fought back, that's why we keep having these problems, because we are just the biggest lames in the world, and white people can just do whatever they want to us and treat us terrible, and we just take it because we're just lames. That's the sort of thing that you should keep in mind, that there has been a concerted racist effort to make sure that we do not know about the litany, because it's not just Nat Turner, the litany of black people who have fought back, including killing individuals classified as white, to try to solve this problem. That was number one. Also, this reminds me a lot of Spook Who Sat by the Door, in terms of the different, done in a different manner, but the same effect to suppress the number of people who could see Birth of a Nation. Spook Who Sat by the Door reminds me of that a lot, and since both films dealt with black counter violence. Also, it reminds me a lot of just the comparison, those two projects, and the way that people continue to gush about Django Unchained, which I despised as well, the female caller that talked about 12 Years a Slave. That's another slave flick that I did not enjoy. There was one other thing I was going to make sure that I got in. I'll leave it. I'll see if I can do it quick, since the caller, Ken Steele in Chicago, since he mentioned the black female and her problems. I'll see if I can do the lineup. For people who appreciate context of white supremacy and think you get some constructive information, you should be pleased. We will be on the air starting Monday. We'll be on every day for roughly 2 weeks, very active for October. So I think I have the lineup memorized, what it's supposed to be. So Monday, we'll be here. Natasha Marin, she's a black female right here in Washington State. She did the website. It got a lot of attention kind of the end of the summer. It's for reparations, where if you're a black person, you can log on and just put down things that you need, things, whatever your request is, and then see if whites would be willing to help you obtain that. It got a lot of attention. She should be here on Monday, so-called Columbus Day. They changed it here to Indigenous People Day. That's Monday. Tuesday, the black female that was mentioned facing 54 years of prison time, she uses the handle Charlo Green to talk online. She should be here on Tuesday to talk about what is happening to her, her endeavors with cannabis in Alaska, where it has been legalized. And I told her up front my view that I did not think legalizing was going to stop this sort of thing from happening to black people. So she already knows Gus's stance. Wednesday, Anthony Morgan, he's a black male. He works in law in Canada. He should be here to talk about what's been happening with white supremacy in Canada. Thursday is Workplace Racism. Friday, the book club, Sam Greenlee's Spook Who Sat by the Door, second to last session. Saturday, a week from today, compensatory call-in. The following week from tomorrow would be the Global Sunday Talk on Racism. The next day, that would be Monday, October 19th, a white woman, she wrote that report that was in the Washington Post and a few other places, saying explicitly that whites do not want black professors at their historically
white institutions. And she spells out all the reasons why, how they have code words, when they just don't want to hire any Negros, how they will, you know, break the rules and do whatever they want to get white people in. They will make any excuse and every obstacle to keep Negros out. She'll be here Monday. Tuesday, the white author of Blood at the Root, which deals with the racial cleansing that happened in Forsyth County, Georgia, the same county where the white teacher was calling First Lady Michelle Obama a monkey. That county, his book just came out, Blood at the Root, just within the past few weeks. He'll be here on Tuesday, the 18th. The next day, Wednesday, the 19th. So that's a week from this coming Wednesday. Who's coming on that day? It's a black person. It's a black person. I just can't remember who it is at the top of my head. And then Charles Woods at the end of that week on Sunday. I know a lot of people were familiar with his work on television, entertainment, racism in Hollywood. He should be here at the end of the week. So that's like 2 weeks from tomorrow, Sunday, October 23rd. I think that should be everybody coming for the next 2 weeks starting Monday. Every day it's normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific for all of the programs except the compensatory call-ins, but we should be very active over the next two-week period or so. We'll be looking forward to it. Any other folks have anything quickly they need to make sure they get in before we move forward?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to tag on to an announcement that I think you made 2 weeks ago regarding the dissemination of fake news on social media. The people who are in charge of putting out fake news are becoming very, very sophisticated with the means with which they are presenting this fake news. One way that they are now circumventing Facebook's attempts to limit the exposure of their sites is to write articles as contributors to pages that allow you to contribute as a freelancer. They use sites like Medium and Huffington Post and Mike to give more, credibility to the stories that they post on these pages that are being tagged as fake news sites. So be very, very careful about the sources that you are citing when posting news. I post news regularly on Facebook, in my group and on my page. And one thing that I've noticed is that if you do not take the time to read some of these seemingly credible sources of information, you could be spreading some fake news or deliberately false news unwittingly. So be very, very careful about the sources that you pick to get your news from. And I guess that's all.
Amen. Advise scrutiny. I guess the female caller that was talking about the game situation, did you want to share one quick portion before we get ready to wrap things up, if she's still with us?
Yes. May we hear?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Just real quick, I guess I'll ask you while I'm on the line. Perhaps we could get the person who is responsible for Mafia 3. The lead dev, his name is Hayden Blackman, and he's a white person. I've also noticed in my brief research when they were taking reviews or being interviewed, they were all being interviewed by white people, so I think it would be good to have them on the program. So some black people can ask them some questions and they can tell us how we're supposed to feel about racism, since he is in charge of the development and the story. Real quick, I can get to some of these reviews. Some of these came from Steam, the PC version of the game, but regardless, some of them came from YouTube. You can kill racist blanks, the KKK in this game. Can't get better than that. 10 out of 10.
I already love this game. When I first heard James Brown, I Feel Good on the radio, I knew this was the game for me. And the fact that they're not influenced by political correctness amazes me. It shows good and bad qualities of the era. This whole game is racist against whites. I, for one, will be killing every black citizen I see and killing as few whites as I can. I can't wait to beat up a few racist KKK losers. I'm going to mash their heads into the pavement with great enthusiasm. I also look forward to playing Mafia 3 when it's released. Black Rambo revenge story. Crazy taxi driving, shooting with one hand. This should be a Mafia game, not some cheap copy of GTA. Why can't I play like White Boy? This is racism shit. The only problem with this game is the extreme boring plot about racial revenge and racism. I wonder what they'll do next. A Mafia game about feminist criminals taking revenge against men? Of course, this is just more diversity shilling by the left. We'll not be buying this cucked game. Rest in peace, Mafia. The first thing a new dev company does is it give it a non-white character and act like it's normal. Yeah, okay. I think they type in just blocks. I think it cool. The only reason most are mad about this game is the main guy is black. That it. And a few pros I picked up where they just write pros and cons of the game. Pro, stores reject you because you're black. Another pro was, I like riding around in the cars. The coloreds call you nigger. And that's all I had.
Fascinating.
If you want to check out Mafia 3, I'll be playing it after the compensatory. Medicinal Gamer on Twitch. twitch.tv/medicinalgamer.
Wow. What a hoot. Switch on over. You can check her Facebook page, or my Facebook page, excuse me. You'll see her twitch.tv account. You can check the link and go watch her play this racist game. I will email Mr. Blackman and see if he's willing to come speak with us.
Or maybe someone else on the dev team as well, because they're all white people.
Right on. We'll see if we can make it happen. I will enjoy my last day off tomorrow before we get busy for the next, whatever it is, 14, 15 days. Allison Manswell, that was the name I forgot. She'll be here October 19th. She wrote the book Listen Up. This is a black female who wrote a whole book about workplace racism. I played an audio clip of her back this summer. It was right after the shootings with Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, kind of mid-July. But they played a segment talking about how to deal with some of these issues on the job. But she wrote a whole book. She should be here the 19th. If you have problems, gripes, guest suggestions, feel free to drop us an email, and we will try to get it cleared up for you promptly. Untiljustice@gmail.com. I did see some of the Luke Cage animated series that came out. I did see that generated a lot of hubbub. It's well done. It's, I guess, some black people get an opportunity to work and show their skills and what have you. Always great to see some very attractive black females. But there's a lot of anti-blackness, at least in my opinion. I saw one person, they said they watched like 6 episodes in one day. Like, I had a tough time. I think it took me like a week to get through 6 episodes. It's just a lot of anti-blackness, seeing black people fighting and killing other black people in a very vulgar, graphic manner frequently. And even like the corrupt whites somehow end up having like mourners who just love them and the whole nine, like just a lot of anti-blackness. Like there's some positive elements in it as well. I can see where they try to bring out racism and some other aspects, but you have to digest a lot of anti-blackness if you're going to watch the series. At times I felt myself saying that this cannot be that much different from Empire.
I'll just leave that and folks can hear a thought or two if they have seen the series. We'll be here Monday and every day following Monday for a while. So just stay tuned. You can see all the program times at blacktalkradionetwork.com. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. I will again remind folks, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. War is being waged against non-white people, black people in particular, worldwide, in all areas of people activity. You want your counter-racist understanding reflected in your conduct at all times. Being under the influence of anything, cigarettes, alcohol, whatever it is, I just have not seen where that is helping us to think better and make great decisions to solve this problem, neutralize racist man, racist woman, racist child. Particularly if you're going to be in a vehicle, you want to be sober. You do not want to be in a car and have that be the day that you bump into Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any other race soldier, badge or no. It can be a life-ending, life-altering situation quickly, like in a matter of seconds. Sobriety would be best. With that, thanks again for tuning in. Remain codified for the rest of the weekend. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.